I mean, what's Pro Football Focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFF.
Do you not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco?
You just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, Sam.
So,
who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football season, all the things that go with it.
Welcome into the PFF NFL podcast. Steve Pelazzolo back here with Sam Monson. It's bright and early on Monday morning after maybe the greatest division around, maybe the greatest weekend in football history. That's what they're calling it, Sam.
Who's they?
Peter King.
Oh, okay.
Look, I mean, the guy, he's like the key historian.
Well, he knows, yeah. He's been doing this a while.
Oh, I do it, you know. Give me a minute to get into my... To my Peter King.
You didn't notice that the entire city here is painted orange. Every building that could light up is now lit up orange.
Half asleep driving in this morning. I was
things
half
that
asleep.
Are usually blue or white or whatever. It's all orange now. Uday.
I'll take a look next week.
Okay.
Or next time I drive in the wee hours of the morning.
Right.
I'll notice.
Yeah.
Tyler, do you notice the city?
Tyler knows.
Being orange? I don't know. People are excited here in Cincinnati. Incredible weekend. The first three games of the divisional round all came down to a road team game-winning walk-off field goal.
Yep.
And then maybe the greatest
one went to overtime.
Yeah, and one of the greatest games of all time, overtime. We've got a lot of overtime discourse this morning, Sam.
None of which will be taking place on this podcast.
There will be no... We could do 3 hours worth of a show here.
Don't want it. Don't care.
We don't want to touch on overtime discourse.
Don't care about overtime. I just don't. I don't care.
No, you would rather dissect, rugby plays in depth
literally
for an hour
anything.
And a half.
Not even rugby, just anything.
Go into
anything.
Any other rule, you know.
I can't find it in me to care about overtime. I just can't.
So you think it's perfect?
No, I think the way it currently is a bad idea. I think every other proposed rule I've seen suggested is also a bad idea. I just do not care.
I think college overtime suggestion is the worst idea for the NFL.
They're all bad, all of them. All of them are bad.
Here we are having discourse.
Don't want it. Move on. Send us emails.
Send
not
us
about,
no,
not
no,
about
no, no, do not.
Overtime.
Do not send us emails about
send
that.
Send us emails.
I will not read overtime emails because I'm not into
anything other than overtime.
I'm not into the overtime discourse.
NFL podcast singular at pff.com. So the money for the tornado thing is gone. Sent off to them. They should have that in hand. I have arranged for a minor forfeit / punishment for us both for that money.
You have?
I'm not going to tell you what it is because I'm pretty sure you'll immediately veto it as a bad idea. But it's in motion, and at some point that will happen.
Yeah,
just to get something done for the tornado money.
Being vetoed as a bad idea.
And then we need...
Is it the peppers?
Then we need the next one. It's not the peppers. I told you, it's not pepper growing season, you know? Even Rick with his indoor growing factory or whatever he's got down there I don't think is... Is firing stuff up right now.
You can't just arbitrarily find a punishment for
it. I can. That's how this works.
It's a co-punishment?
Yeah. And then we'll do... So anyway, we need the next charity. Who are we donating the money to? We need the next idea. The actual sort of proper forfeit, punishment, whatever thing we're doing. There's a lot of people want some kind of dueling, charity thing. It's adding a layer of complexity to this that I'm not sure I'm 100% on board with, but I'm not vetoing it. So anyway, send us ideas, nflpodcast@pff.com or on the Twitter account, @pffnflpod is our official Twitter account there. That's all I got with that.
All right, great. Good work. We're going to get into all the madness here in a minute. But first, we've got an opportunity for you to win a chance for the Ultimate Game Day Feast. Whether it's football success or financial savvy, winning starts with asking us questions. Would you like to know what it's like behind the scenes with Al on Sunday Night Football? How about a need to know for your financial future? Western and Southern's teaming up with Chris Collinsworth, our very own here at PFF, to share insights that will help put you ahead on both your fantasy and financial scoreboards. Every submission earns you a chance to win the Ultimate Feast to celebrate football's favorite Sunday. So that's coming up It's a few weeks away. We'll cover your catering for up to $2,500. Coordinate your order from a restaurant near you and have it delivered on February 13th, 2022. Don't forget to check out the Chris Collinsworth podcast and Western and Southern's Instagram for answers to the best questions each week. Submit your questions at westernsouthern.com/feast. One more time, it's westernsouthern.com/feast. If you're watching on YouTube, we're showing you where it is right now, but also check out the link in the description below. Remember, with Western and Southern, you can rest assured on game day. All right, who rest assured on game day? Well, the Bengals first.
What?
They rest assured. They were resting assured.
Rest assured.
Yeah, yeah. It's a transition, Sam.
Yeah. Not a good one.
It doesn't matter. It was. It was what it was.
Okay.
Bengals win. They're off to the AFC Championship.
They are.
Yeah. It was 19-16. That felt like eons ago. Just to reiterate, the excitement of this weekend. Bengals win 19-16. Walk-off field goal. Evan McPherson, the dude's one of the better kickers in the league right now.
Right now.
Because anybody not named Justin Tucker.
I was thinking. So, the Chiefs game, right? They had Jay Feely, the sideline kicker correspondent, which I've never quite understood as a concept. But, okay, let's roll with it. And no sooner had Jay Feely just started bigging up Harrison Buckner as, like, he's not quite Justin Tucker, but he's right there with him. It's like shank, like doink,
extra,
whatever, right?
Extra immediately point missed, field goal missed.
And when you've got Evan McPherson nailing these kicks, and I was sort of wondering, he's doing really well right now. How quickly before he's cut and kicking for somebody else, right? Like, remember when Blair Walsh did this for the Vikings, or now like Daniel Carlson got cut and is now one of the best kickers ever for somebody else. Like, we are 6 months away from the Bengals cutting this guy and him going on to have a second career for somebody else, having shanked five kicks straight. And yet somehow Mason Crosby just continues on trucking for the same team despite going through like five of those career...
Going through the yips.
Right, career-killing stretches.
So the big... Many stories coming out of this Bengals-Titans game. So this is where we're going to start. And each game got progressively better and crazier. I mean, I think that you could honestly say that. They were all crazy in their own right. Maybe the 49ers-Packers was the second craziest, but I think
this was
literally
the most
got
normal
worse.
Game.
The most normal
game. And yet it was just a routine, really close, exciting game.
Yet Joe Burrow gets sacked 9 times
right.
in a victory.
So, Ruth, the most normal, routine game, and yet it set an NFL record. That's how crazy this weekend was.
You were doing some research on the sack totals, right?
Yeah. During the game, it became apparent that this was getting kind of crazy, right? Burrow is going down constantly with sacks, and you're like, what is the most number of sacks a guy has taken and still won a playoff game? Because we've got to be approaching it. Turns out the number was 9. 8, depending on like when you drew the line. Like, in order to get to 9, you have to go back to the AFL. The Chiefs. Len Dawson. By the way, that game, nuts. Apparently, in an AFL championship game, Len Dawson won a game 31-7, having been sacked 9 times.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I don't know that at all.
Since the merger, I think Donovan McNabb, the 4th and 26 game against the Packers, like that was the last time, and that was 8.
Didn't McNabb have a couple of those games where he got sacked like 8 to 10 times? Ridiculous number.
Yeah, but that was the only one where a guy had won, was that 4th and 26 game where he'd been sacked 8 times. So this game, Joe Burrow sacked 9 times, the most a guy has ever taken since the merger and still won a game, which is craziness.
This was weird because everybody's going to be talking about the pressure and the Bengals offensive line and pass protection and all that stuff, and it wasn't good overall, but it was also one of those games where like every pressure turned into a sack.
Yeah,
so it wasn't like
they gave up 22 or they gave up 13 pressures total.
Yeah,
9 of which were sacks.
So they were just the thing about an actual sack is it's not, again, we talk about this all the time, we've used the research says it's more of a QB driven stat. I think what was happening in this game was the Titans were just taking away Joe Burrow's first read a lot. And on these particular plays, I mean, there was some quick pressure in there too, but on these particular plays, if he held the ball just a tick and came back to something else, he was done on these particular plays, right? On a bunch of them. There was other plays where, might have been on Burrow, getting rid of the ball and all this stuff. So, but it wasn't like the Bengals got absolutely smoked up front, especially even compared to other offensive lines. But this was a weekend of defensive fronts and defensive until we saw the fireworks late in the Chiefs-Bills game. It was very much a defense-oriented weekend, right? Especially on Saturday.
Yeah, but it's also like it really was. I can't. It's very hard to articulate this, but it was quote unquote just those plays. Like, if you were watching this game, you could easily come away with the impression that like Jeffrey Simmons was the best player in the NFL this week, right? Four sacks. Each one of those four sacks was him absolutely wrecking his guy, getting into the backfield, stuffing the play, and just annihilating him, right? But he rushed the passer 43 times and had five pressures. So four sacks and one additional pressure, which is, I mean, it's reasonable. It's pretty good. Like, four sacks is fantastic. But usually when that happens, you get a guy with four sacks, and that guy will have, like, double-digit pressures. He's in the backfield constantly. Just by the nature of these things, you need that volume of pressure to get that kind of production. It's like, you know, a striker in soccer. Like, very rarely do they score every shot that they have, right? You need a bunch of opportunities, and then you get X number of goals off the back of that. Jeffrey Simmons had a sack almost every single time he got pressure, which is just weird.
So the Bengals got up 16-6 in this game. And then the game really gets turned on, and it gets to 16-9. Interception by Amani Hooker. Hooker has a couple huge plays in this game, but it was Tennessee scores, kicks a field goal, so it's 16-9. It's the third quarter. Joe Burrow pass slightly off, slash dropped to Samaje Perine. Bounces up. Amani Hooker comes diving in and catches the ball off the turf. Another one of those debatable types of plays. The ball hit the ground, but it didn't really move. Either way, great play by Amani Hooker. Titans come back. Ryan Tannehill.
Very mad if they'd taken that off the board because it touched the ground. Like, that was a pick.
The Bert Emanuel rule.
I also think, so Mitchell Schwartz has made this point. I think that is a perfect example of it, that for certain things, you should only be allowed to slow the tape down so much.
Yeah.
Right? Under any normal speed, that's an easy interception. You wouldn't question it at all. The slower you made it, the more it looked like, oh, I don't know, I touched the ground. Is it a pick? Like, stop. Stop slowing it down. You don't need to. Any normal speed, it's just a pick.
Did you almost go full Romo there?
Yeah.
I don't know, Jim. We see it on the ground, and it's rubbing against the dirt, and I don't know if they're going to do it.
Like, the last play of the game, when they started looking at it.
I'm a Romo apologist, because the first, yes.
I don't think it's over, Jim.
The first inner
like, what are you talking about? Of course it's over. Like, they're both feet are in.
The first replay that they showed with Kelce, both feet were in. The Travis Kelce walk-off touchdown. Both feet were in, but the first replay they showed, it did look like when he went to the ground, it bounced. Then when they flipped to the other side, it like didn't even come close to bouncing. It was absolutely a catch. Don't take Romo's enthusiasm away from him. Do not take it away from him. But yeah, he would have gone nuts on the Samani Hooker interception had he been in the booth.
What did you make of the whole Derrick Henry thing? Because that was obviously the story coming to this game. Derrick Henry's back, Superman, metal plate in his foot, bionic human, and then first play of the game. I actually think this was a really smart call. They went play action. They didn't give him the ball.
Yeah.
They went play action. He tried to hit A.J. Brown over the top, and Jesse Bates was just like, ready for it. Yoink, just grabs the interception.
The first two, you made this point, right? The first two passes of each half for Ryan Tannehill were intercepted. Yeah.
I mean, I think that was a smart call. Like, everybody in the world is expecting Derrick Henry to get the first carry, right? The guy hasn't played for months.
He's back.
He's back is the story. We're going to feed Derrick Henry until the wheels fall off. And literally first play, we go play action. We try and hit A.J. Brown over the top, which is the thing that Derrick Henry opens up. And Jesse Bates just jumps in front of it, grabs an interception.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was a good play, bad decision by Tannehill.
Yeah, but I think it was the right call. Like, I think it was a smart play call, and Jesse Bates was just absolutely ready for it and immediately gets Cincinnati off to a fantastic start.
It did. So there's a lot at stake here. I mean, Henry was okay in this game. I thought he was fine. You know, he didn't break.
No, Dante Foreman. But
Dante Foreman was the one who did break the big run. Had a long of 45, had four carries for 66 yards. I mean, Tennessee.
I like Renner's tweet.
Still ran the ball.
How many people do you think are under the impression that Derrick Henry rattled off that big run?
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, I mean, not anymore because it happened so long ago and a lot of stuff's happened since then and they lost. But
this was Cincinnati's first ever road playoff win.
Really?
They've been to two Super Bowls before and they were 0-7 on the road.
I didn't even realize that. Joe Burrow's Joe Cool over here. I mean, that's the Joe Montana comps.
What kind of vibes are you getting from Joe Burrow right now? Because we're starting to get to a weird place of, you know, everybody making Joe Montana type of comps to him.
It's kind of like the tough thing in analysis, the way we do it at a play-by-play level and all that stuff. Because I'm gonna go back to his second to last year at LSU, and he. And I don't know if this was just because LSU had been coming off a decade plus of some of the worst quarterback play you've ever seen. Joe Burrow had like a good solid grade that particular year. He was a good quarterback. But I remember LSU fans saying, we have our Tom Brady in Joe Burrow. This was before his Heisman season, before his dominant Heisman season, because he had shown flashes. And I know a lot of our colleagues in the analytics community and analytics Twitter and, you know, that corner of NFL Twitter that's lives and dies by the spreadsheets and R will mock the NFL evaluators who will be like, oh, he just has it, right? When you're looking at Joe Burrow, and this was like the decider between Joe Burrow and Justin Herbert. Oh, he just has it. Well, we'll give Joe Burrow the credit.
They both have it.
What's that?
Turns out they both have it.
They both have it, right? But some people took Joe Burrow. He's just a winner and all that stuff.
Tua doesn't have it.
Not it. Certainly not it. It being like enough arm to make these throws. I mean, but that's the thing, right? Because there's also a section of people who don't think, oh, Joe Burrow, poo armed, you know, number one overall pick and all this
stuff.
There
was a lot of people that did not like Joe Burrow as a number one overall pick.
Yeah. And
they didn't necessarily have an alternative.
Like, and they were going in on him last year.
Yeah.
For like a few throws and stuff like that. All I'm saying is, even there was something that LSU fans even saw before he was really good, because he had these moments, right? And then he goes out in the national title run, and just every time the pressure was on, that dude stepped up. And I think he's still showing it right now. The guy just got sacked 9 times. Some of that's his doing. It's his fault.
Sure.
But he gets out there and makes throw after throw after throw. He throws that deep out. I don't care. This was like, I don't care what it looks like velocity-wise. Now, Josh Allen, we'll get to him, and his velocity and stuff matters. Joe Burrow's timing and accuracy on deep out routes and all this stuff is unreal. And he is just cool and calm under pressure. And I think that it factor, whatever you want to call it, means something. And Burrow's got it. And it doesn't mean you're going to win every game. It just means the moment's not going to be too big. And it means even in a game where things aren't great, I mean, you know, Brady yesterday, in the not close to Brady's best game, but they're still going to be in it at the end and all that, you know. Joe Burrow's going to have the Bengals in a lot of games through the years because he's really good at football. And because when the moment gets big, it doesn't seem to faze him at all.
Yeah. He had 9.4 yards per attempt whilst getting sacked 9 times. He racked up almost 350 yards. What I'm really liking about him at the moment is he has that. So he has that Brady Montana thing of it feels inevitable, right?
Yeah.
Like, isn't there that? So you give those guys an opportunity, and you know they're taking it. Like, there's not a debate. I mean, this Mahomes has this as well. Like, when we'll get to that game later, but when I texted you last night, it was like 2 minutes with Mahomes. Like, forget it. Like, don't even. The game is done. Like, what now? I didn't expect him to score, then another score, and then another score after that. But the point is, 2 minutes with Mahomes with the ball, we know he's scoring. Like, it's not even up for debate. That you're getting that feeling. You always had it with Tom Brady that if you give him that opportunity, he will make it happen, even if it's not pretty. Burrow, the same thing. But also, he has that swagger and treads that line between like arrogance and confidence where, you know, he has been saying all along that like the Bengals are for real. They're not just like screwing around here. We are, why not us, was his speech, right? Like, this is not a team that backed into the playoffs. It was never really worth their seeding and can't hang with the biggest teams in the league. We're here now, and we have designs on winning this thing, not just showing up and going like having a nice account of ourselves in the playoffs. Like, they're now in the AFC Championship game against a team they know they can beat. And Burrow is like, why are we not thinking Super Bowl here? Like, this is our goal. I did this in college. I won a national title. I am looking to bring a ring to Cincinnati. Like, that's a hell of a thing to be going out and saying publicly with the kind of confidence that he has. Like, there's a difference there between a guy who sort of deep down probably knows that he's not really at this kind of level and a guy who just goes, no, this is, like, these are the standards.
This is what I do.
We are shooting for a Super Bowl, and that's what we're aiming for.
So I know Matthew Stafford is in the NFC Championship, and he's coming off a great game yesterday, and he did a lot to be in this position. But the thing that people said about Stafford for years was, oh, he was stuck with the Lions. He was stuck with this horrible franchise.
Burrow was stuck with the Bengals and now has him in the AFC Championship game.
That's the other factor. So, like, when you look at Brady going to New England, the previous years in New England were not good, and then all of a sudden things flip, right? Mahomes with the Chiefs, he went to a good situation that then became great, right? So when you're looking at these,
I think there's a buy-in there, right? It's because of this stuff where when he says that, people believe it. If, like, I hate to bring it back to, like, Stafford for one, but like Kirk Cousins would be the great example. Like, Kirk Cousins has played at a level that isn't an awful lot, like, not a million miles away from Burrow is right now. But if Kirk Cousins was like, "We're heading to the Super Bowl, boys," everyone would be like, "Yeah, sure you are." Like, send us a postcard when you're there. You know what I mean? Let us know what it's like. Nobody's buying into that, you know? Whereas Burrow says it, everyone's like, all right, let's go. Let's saddle up.
Right? I mean, and that's why you get the Joe Montana comps, and Brady was always getting the Joe Montana comps.
Yeah.
And Joe Montana was Brady's hero, which is interesting, right? Like, Brady had a lot of the Montana type of stuff, right? By the way, there's a nice do you watch any of the Montana documentary?
I haven't watched it yet. I'm going to at some point, though.
I'm like halfway through the first episode. It's interesting. It does feel like it's going to be a big, like, chip on your shoulder type of, you know, Joe talking about him being an underdog throughout the years. That stuff is interesting, though, right? As much as we do play-by-play analysis and all that stuff, the fact that a lot of these greatest quarterbacks of all time didn't, you know, Peyton Manning was like the only guy, not the only guy, but one of those few guys that had that pure path to number one overall pick, to, like, never was really bad unless you say, you know, he had 28 interceptions his rookie season.
Right, but, like, pillar to post was just anointed as the great one.
But you would look at Peyton or Elway as these, you know, number one overall picks, like a wire-to-wire greatness type of thing. A lot of the other guys, the Montanas and Bradys and Aaron Rodgers of the world, didn't have that path. Drew Brees, there's more. Mahomes, right? These guys had a different path. And Burrow's that guy too, right? Like, they didn't pick him as the starting quarterback at Ohio State. He went to LSU, had just a good season, and then since 2019 has been absolutely great. Look at that. It's Joe and Joe, Burrow and Montana here on the YouTube channel. All that said, I mean, there's something to Joe Burrow's going to have the Bengals up here for a while. If for nothing else, he's a great player. And for whatever that other stuff is worth, behind the scenes belief and this and that whole Montana's in the huddle being like, "Hey guys, it's John Candy. We're about to win the Super Bowl. You know, game's on the line. But hey, look, there's John Candy in the stands." I don't know. Burrow's got some of that, the touchy-feely stuff that you can't quantify.
Yeah, it really is. And I think there's a degree of this buy-in, though, that makes things different. Like, there's something about those guys. Like, when we were doing the research for the Montana versus Steve Young podcast that we did the other summer, it was so interesting talking to people, you know, former teammates, Ronnie Lott, guys like that, who knew that all you had to do was give Joe Montana a chance at the end of the game, right? It didn't matter that you were only there because Joe Montana had thrown three interceptions already. Like, just give him the ball with 2 minutes left and you're going to win. There's a buy-in that those guys have that it's difficult to pinpoint exactly why. Because, you know, like, again, you were a big part of us being in this not ideal situation right now. But they just had complete and total confidence that guy would get it done in the key moment. And Montana had that. Brady had that. Joe Burrow appears to have that. And I, like, obviously it's early. The guy has got 1 year now of elite PFF grading, and the year is not over yet. So he could easily come back down to earth next year and regress and not quite be the same player. But right now, there is this total degree of buy-in that Joe Burrow is going to be one of the great quarterbacks going forward, and it's difficult to argue with.
Yeah, so look, it doesn't mean he's a perfect player. There's definitely room to grow. There's a lot. There's a lot more to do. There's more to go for Joe Burrow, and it's not just him. I mean, in this particular game, the 19-16 win against the Titans did do a really nice job scheming it up front, getting that pressure and finishing those pressures. The importance of finishing and turning him into sacks. We'll talk about that in the Bills-Chiefs game because Mahomes was slithering out of sacks left and right in that particular game. But the Tennessee Titans did a really nice job of pressuring. The end of the game now.
A couple of shout-outs in this game,
yeah.
I think. DJ Reader was making plays
in the run game,
throughout, which was huge. Obviously, Tennessee with Derrick Henry back, with Dante Foreman in there, like – DJ Reader was taking it upon himself with, remember, the Bengals defensive line banged up, missing a couple of guys. They've been like calling defensive tackles up randomly throughout the week, just trying to get bodies there. DJ Reader basically personally made it his life's mission to stop the run in this game. Did a really good job of it. Clay Johnson was someone I thought, like, so this is a guy who's played like less than 50 snaps over the season. For two different teams, right? Complete, like, bottom-of-the-roster type of guy, barely plays, special teams primarily, and then solo tackle off the edge to stop a Derrick Henry two-point attempt, right? Just imagine, like, going from those sort of quote-unquote lows, you know, I'm not really a consequential person on this team, to I just made one of the biggest plays of the game on my own against Derrick Henry
in goal line defense
to stop 2 points going on the board. Like, just a huge moment for him, which must be pretty awesome as a thing. And then Mike Hilton had one of the biggest plays out there. And Mike Hilton has been playing really well recently. They've put him on an island against some pretty tough opposition in recent weeks. Goes out there and, like, single-handedly snags himself an interception with a, you know, batting, comes on the blitz from the slot, bats it up in the air, catches his own interception, and off to the races.
Jesse Bates had that interception that you said, too. Bates did not have, in a contract, you know, big contract year. He's looking for a deal and all that stuff, for a big deal. And his two best games have been the last 2 weeks, making a ton of plays on the ball. Chidobe Awuzie did not have his best effort this particular week. But Awuzie and Mike Hilton, I feel like we spent 95% of our time talking about the Bengals offense this offseason, but those two additions this offseason to this defense.
The Bengals defense generally last offseason had an incredible offseason, and it wasn't one that we liked at the time. Like, they essentially decided, we're not going to pay William Jackson, we're not going to play Carl Lawson, we're going to ship those guys off, and those are arguably two of their best defenders, and we're going to replace them in free agency. Like, we're not even going to sort of turn to the draft and try and get younger, cheaper players. We're going to pay Trey Hendrickson, coming off a career year in which his sack number was kind of inflated relative to how good he was. We're going to bring in Awuzie. We're going to bring in Mike Hilton. And they've all worked out. Like, all of those moves have been fantastic. And I think that defense has been upgraded because of it.
Ryan Tannehill at quarterback. So he ends up with three interceptions. That first one that we mentioned, the first play of the game. I think the other two great plays slash unlucky, the other two. So the ones, the Mike Hilton play, which was absolutely massive play because the Titans, Dante Foreman just reeled off the 45-yard run.
Do we have like we have a ruling on that? Dante versus Deontay?
I think it's Dante.
Because people, it's one of those ones where like some broadcast booths are like, Deontay.
Maybe I just, because I heard it. I heard Dante the other day. I think it's Dante.
It should be. It should be.
We're professionals. We're supposed to know.
Yeah. I'm gonna make a claim to you and see how you react to it. There's not a quarterback in the NFL that I would rather have chasing down his own interception than Ryan Tannehill.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
A defensive back plucked this one out of the sky, took off running, and was never even close to taking that back for a touchdown because Tannehill was like reeling him in at a massive rate of knots.
Tannehill, he's got good spatial awareness.
Remember,
former
also,
receiver, by the way.
Yes. Yeah. Remember also, he owns, I can't remember what the highlight thing was, but there was some kind of highlight package I was seeing recently where it was, do you remember Tannehill absolutely smoking some guy after an interception or a fumble return? Like, he comes from the middle of the field and just buries a dude. Like, one of the best tackles you're ever going to see. absolutely lays him out. There's not a, he's got elite speed. Now, apparently, he can hit like a train.
Does he replace Ben Roethlisberger?
Yes.
Who did not, it wasn't an interception, it was that fumble that he said back in 05.
Roethlisberger was a tackle in a phone booth kind of guy, whereas Tannehill will hawk you down from wherever you are in the field.
Gotcha. Yeah, yeah. Tannehill, good angle there. I just want to discuss the last interception because the end of the game was fascinating. So the Titans have 3rd and 5, 28 seconds left. It's a tie game. They're on their own 40-yard line, and it's a simple all-curl call. All-curl. So you have the three outside receivers essentially running. Yeah, it wasn't all curls, but it's a curl route that he threw. They're all running vertical routes well beyond the sticks. So it's about a 15-yard pass. And, you know, on the broadcast cam, it's like, oh, he forced it. It's not. I mean, it's a little forced, but it might be a touch late from Tannehill. This interception, though, is not on him. This is not like an egregious decision where he threw the ball to the defense. It was a great defensive play that's tipped up. And normally that pass hits the ground 98% of the time.
It's also like if a flag had come out for illegal contact, pass interference, whatever. Like, Eli Apple was pretty hyper-aggressive on that play. If they'd thrown a yellow flag, I don't think anybody really would have been complaining.
Now, you could make the argument that throwing to Westbrook Akina in a crunch time or whatever.
Tightly covered. Yeah, it's not the smartest thing in the world.
Yeah, and when you're talking tightly covered, again, you're throwing this ball as the receiver's going into his break. You're throwing it. He's in between. He's in front of the corner,
right?
So he's got to work back to it, and then you presumably make the corner work through the receiver to make the play. Eli Apple played it perfectly.
Yeah.
And if that, so again, my only point on this is, if that pass hits the ground, as it would 98% of the time, you're just like, oh, okay, good play, Eli Apple. Now we're going to punt, and the Bengals are going to get the ball with about 20 seconds left, and they're going to take a knee, and we're going to overtime. Instead, the ball just got tipped up. Logan Wilson, this wasn't a throw into triple coverage. Right. Like, Logan Wilson's just getting into his zone. He comes back, and the ball lands in his hands. He makes a nice play, turns upfield, picks up some yardage, and then Joe Burrow makes a throw to get the ball into field goal range.
Yeah.
So all I'm saying is this wasn't like an egregious late-game decision by Ryan Tannehill here. It was a great play by the Bengals defense to force a turnover.
It was. And the Bengals defense made some legit plays throughout the course of it. We talked about DJ Reader. With about 7 minutes left, their defensive line stood on third and short and then fourth and short. The first one, it looked like Tannehill could have given that to Derrick Henry and not pulled it himself and gone nowhere. Like, that actually looked like something that might have been converted. Fourth down was just never, they never had a shot. Like, the Bengals defense had that absolutely blanketed. Their D stood big in a lot of critical plays throughout this game. And even, like, the deep touchdown to A.J. Brown, it's pretty tight coverage. Like, that was like a teaching tape from A.J. Brown in terms of how you're supposed to do that with late hands, is the term, right?
Late hands.
So he did exactly what you don't do, like the opposite, right? A.J. Brown basically reacts to that as the ball shows up. And, like, immediate reaction, turns, grabs it one-handed, it turns out, because the DB's got that close of coverage. When you react that late, there's literally nothing the DB can do. He can't react in time after your reaction to make any kind of play on the ball or the receiver. That's why they teach that. You apparently do the opposite, where your hands are so early that the receiver has or the DB has like reacted, wondered why the ball hasn't arrived, and then it somehow, like, during the time where he's wondering what the hell is going on, is when the ball drops into your hands.
You're referring to my 70-yard touchdown against you? How many yards was that, really?
Because I'm probably, because there's not a hope in hell you could get to 70.
I have, I'll have to check the stat sheet, but I have a 70-yard scamper in UMass Lowell flag football.
I don't think you could run 70 yards.
70 yards from the quarterback position.
Yeah.
Just ran away from the defense. Mm. Just like I ran away from you for at least 50. The great Zach Robinson.
Running away.
One game away from the Super Bowl, Zach Robinson putting it right on my hands.
Yeah.
Which were up.
For about 8 seconds, yeah.
For about 10 yards.
Yeah.
10 yards, 8 seconds. Yeah, it's about right.
Right, yeah. So you did the exact opposite of late hands. Your hands were so early that it threw everything off from people that play the game of football.
I'm back and forth on this Derrick Henry take here. He gets 20 carries, and I know we've seen him, you know, be at 20 for 62 for so long, and then there's your 50-yarder to make the yards per carry look pretty good. But I have to say, throwing the ball to A.J. Brown, who did make that great catch on the 41-yarder. He only A.J. Brown ends up with 9 targets. Football's not as simple as throw the ball to the receiver, you know, the same number of times as you hand it to a running back. But, man, A.J. Brown is the real difference maker in this offense. More of a difference maker, I would say, than Henry. And I feel like
this is why the Derrick Henry thing was always going to be a difficult problem for them to work out. Because was Derrick Henry 100% in this game? No, probably not. Was he the more explosive Tennessee running back in this game? No. But you know that Derrick Henry has this history of keep giving him the ball, keep loading him up. Late in the game, that's when he breaks off something. So do you keep doing that if he's not 100%? Or do you like work out a pivot during the game of like, you know what, this is not really Derrick Henry out there. It's just a dude that, you know, looks like him. And kind of go away from that late in the game and use him as that decoy. Now, they did that like right at the start of the game, right? Like play number one, play action. We're not even going to give him the ball.
Yeah, do that.
But late in the game, you saw those. They were still giving him the ball in that 4th and 1. It's like, it's not working. Like they're prepared for it. I think that was always going to be a difficult thing for the Titans. But ultimately, like, Bengals defense stood up big. They made some plays when they need to. And I think they were deserved winners.
One last thing. Ja'Marr Chase goes 5 catches for 109. The long one was a 57-yarder, just quick screen against zero blitz, right? I can't believe how dynamic Ja'Marr Chase is.
His ability to make people miss in short areas is silly.
Yeah. So, like, coming out, I was like, Ja'Marr Chase reminds me of a bigger Antonio Brown. And then I was like, kind of reminds me of Jordy Nelson, too. So, like, these two really high-end receivers. And I may have still underestimated Chase because he's so dynamic in short spaces. I don't think I saw that.
No, you did, because you talked – the Antonio Brown comp is perfect because, like Antonio Brown, you're like, I don't quite know why this is working.
You're right.
Because I had the same – I missed on Antonio Brown because when I saw him playing college, you're like, there's no reason that this is making people look as stupid as it is, right? He's not fast. Like, the things he's doing, when you look at his measurables and stuff, he's like an average athlete. And yet he's making people look absolutely stupid through just simple, quick moves. You know, like one quick step this way and then back that way. And a dude is like falling over face first and Brown's off to the races. Like, I was like, all right, that's fine at wherever he was, Central Michigan. But in the NFL, that's not going to cut it unless you're a super athlete. But it turns out it works. And Ja'Marr Chase is a similar thing. You're like, all he did is took one step to his right. Why is everybody like lying on the ground nowhere near him?
Yeah.
So I think it's exactly the same thing. Like you saw it perfectly, bigger Antonio Brown. And I don't think we figured out yet quite why that style of play is as devastating as it is. But it works.
All right, we're 38 minutes into the show, and we're done with the game. We're right on pace. I don't care if we're here for 5 hours. This is great. It's a great weekend. It's also great to have our friends at Manscaped back. Roses are red, violets are blue. Don't let a wild pube wreck you.
No, don't do it.
It's Valentine's Day. It's just around the corner, and our sponsors at Manscaped are here for you with the best tools to get your balls ready for the special occasion. This V-Day, it's time to join the 4 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped, the leaders and below the waist grooming. With our exclusive offer, go to manscaped.com and use promo code PFF for 20% off plus free shipping. The holidays went by so quickly. Did you remember to take care of your package with the best tools for the job, Sam?
It's a personal question, Steve. Well, thank you to stay
also,
out of my business.
Also rhetorical. The Performance Package 4.0 from Manscaped is just the thing every guy needs in their life to make each and every day just a little more special. I'd like to propose, Manscaped would, making February 13th a national holiday as National Shave Your Balls Day. That's right. They're putting this forward here.
Glad somebody's finally said it.
Who's with me? Also rhetorical. I think this is one holiday that men and women can get behind. Manscaped created their products for a night just like this and will make your V-Day date say, wow, great set of balls you have there. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code PFF. At manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com. Use the promo code PFF. You're going to be really sad if you fast-forwarded this ad.
Yeah.
You never fast-forward a Manscaped ad. Join Cupid and shoot your arrow with Manscaped this Valentine's Day. The promo code is PFF. We're on to Saturday night. only the third craziest game of the weekend. 49ers 13, Packers 10. And we've got a lot going on here. We've got the Aaron Rodgers discussion, contemplating his future. We've got the Niners going in. Boy, was this just glorious. You're pro-weather game, right, you said?
Yeah.
It's Renner that's anti-weather game.
Yeah.
I could see why after this one. But this was just Lambeau and snow, and it feels like zero.
Don't go and listen to our preview of this game because, you know.
Completely off?
Yeah. Both of us were like, you know what? I don't know that either defense can stop the opposition here. Like, it's going to be high scoring. Both offenses are going to be rolling down, scoring at will. Didn't happen so much. Well, the first drive made us look smart. And then from that moment on, we looked like idiots. So
Packers get up. Packers got up 7-0 early.
Yes,
and it looked like they didn't have a plan for Devontae Adams. And mm-hmm. I thought it was well laid out. I think on the broadcast where it was like, look. You can't game plan for Devontae Adams because the Packers do a great job of moving him around, and it's Aaron Rodgers' guy. And
feels like he can game plan that a little bit, you know? Like, how hard is it to anticipate if he moves to the slot? How do we bracket him?
I know, but all I'm saying is after the first drive, I think he had four catches on the first drive. It's like, okay, they're not going to stop him. But then they did a really good job on third down in particular, attacking Devontae Adams and taking him away.
Can you explain to me why Green Bay does this time after time after time? Look unstoppable and then stop. Like, this has been their season. You think every time you're like, oh, look, this Green Bay offense is going to roll. They've got Aaron Rodgers. They got Devontae Adams. Nobody can stop it. They look completely untouchable. And then for giant swathes of play, they just stall and don't keep putting points on the board. And all these weird games, like Cleveland. Remember that? It was like, there was a period in that game where like, oh, this is going to be an ass-kicking. Like, the Packers are just going to roll, and then all of a sudden, they stop scoring. The Browns claw their way back into it, and it was a nail-biter. Like, every single game with the Packers seems to be like this. They just stall out of their own volition. And okay, yeah, the 49ers defense did a great job after that point and made a lot of plays, and Nick Bosa was in, like, but they just seem to be the architect of their own demise. I don't understand why they're so switch on or switch off as an offense.
I don't have a great answer for it. It's not like this happens in every game, but it happens a lot. It happened in 2019. I feel like it was a bigger story, and because we were like, we hadn't seen this before, right? It was Matt LaFleur and Aaron Rodgers' first season, and they looked so much better on script. And maybe that's just the answer. Maybe there are certain teams who are better scripting than they are adjusting. And I thought that the Niners, D'Amico Ryan's getting a lot of hype coming out of this game. And this is where I was wrong. I mean, I thought the Niners defense would get picked apart. I felt like they had been overachieving. I felt like their pass rush, which was good and solid in this game again. I thought their pass rush was going to get negated because Rodgers is getting rid of the ball and getting the ball out of his hands. But this was the interesting thing here is it was almost like the Packers narrative from 2 years ago of, man, they just really need some help for Devontae Adams. They really need some help for Devontae. It felt like it just showed up in this game because obviously Rodgers had been putting up ridiculous numbers. He's probably going to win back-to-back MVPs. It's not like this has been a massive weakness that showed up. Alan Lazard has stepped up before. We've seen Marquez Valdes-Scantling, who missed this game, but we've seen other guys step up. Randall Cobb. In this game, Devontae Adams and Aaron Jones caught 18 of the 20 passes. Now, there were also plays where if you go back and look at it, Rodgers is locked on to Devontae Adams. Yeah. And when the Niners take him away, he's not looking elsewhere.
Late in the game, Devontae Adams was the only wide receiver that had a target. Like they literally hadn't even thrown one.
There was one third down conversion to Lazard, right, for 6 yards, and that was it.
Do you understand what the Packers did with their offensive line? So David Bakhtiari re-aggravated his injury, didn't go in this game, and that was one of the guys they were supposed to be getting back. Za'Darius Smith came back, made an impact. Jair Alexander was another one. And then David Bakhtiari was supposed to be the third of the sort of big reinforcements that were coming. Re-aggravated his injury, didn't go in the game. And rather than play Yosh Nijman, who'd been the starting left tackle without Bakhtiari for like half the season, they didn't. They put Billy Turner at left tackle, Dennis Kelly at right tackle, and Nijman sitting his ass on the bench and not playing at all. Now, it held up okay, but did that not seem like a weird reshuffle to be making?
Yeah, I thought so. I mean, Turner did fine at left tackle. He didn't have the best history there. He played there in the NFC Championship last year.
Nyman would be pretty good.
Like, yeah. I don't think the line was that Lucas Patrick had a poor pass blocking grade. That was pretty much it up front. They were fine, I think, as far as pass protection goes. The Niners just did a really good job taking away Rodgers' first read. And he started to look less comfortable, I would say, as the game went on. After that opening touchdown, the Packers, here are their drives. Fumble, punt, punt, punt. The game book calls this one end of half. This was a blocked field goal.
Right.
End of half. Punt, field goal, blocked punt, touchdown.
Yeah.
And then punt.
The Green Bay Packers have the worst special teams unit I've ever seen in my life. It's a joke how bad it is.
It's really bad.
It's horrendous.
It's tough to be that bad at all phases.
Yeah. Like, it's a complete failure of the system. The entire
field goal
thing.
Kick, field goal block, punt, punt return.
How are they that bad?
I don't know.
Because special teams, it's another one of those things where you don't need to be great. You just need to be not terrible. Like, just don't. All you have to do is roll out every now and again, punt the ball, kick the ball, you know, cover a punt, cover a kick. Just don't be the reason you lose the game.
How hard
is that?
See, I think that's. Remind me to bring up a Packers narrative that you're going to love in a minute.
Okay.
But it's now, when we get to the Final Four, it becomes narrative season, right? So when you get to the Final Four, this is what people do. They look at the Final Four and they're like, this Final Four tells us that you need X, Y, and Z because this is what the Final Four has. So this year it's going to be special teams matters, right? Because the Packers didn't get there because of special teams. Remember, you tweeted the picture in 2017. The Final Four quarterbacks were Tom Brady, naturally.
Triggered a lot of people, that tweet.
Tom Brady, Nick Foles, Blake Bortles, and Case Keenum.
Yep.
The story coming out of that year was like, see, you don't need an elite quarterback. Oh, yeah, you don't need an elite. It's a team game. Don't need an elite quarterback to win a Super Bowl. And like last year, it was Brady and Rodgers, Allen and Mahomes. It was like, okay, you can only win with an elite quarterback, right? Like the narrative of the Final Four.
That photo just cracks me up because can you imagine, like, you know, in 8 or 10 years' time when Tom Brady's retired with his 17 rings, can you imagine showing somebody that picture and being like, this was one of the years he didn't win?
This was not one of them, right? He lost in the Super Bowl to one of these guys. My point is you're going to hear people talk about the Final Four and stuff, and this is going to be like a special teams matters thing. I just think, much like the offensive line, just don't be horrible. Like,
yeah.
So much of football, like, yes, you have to put resources into this. Just don't be a train wreck.
It matters, but only insofar as, like, you just can't be horrendous at it. Green Bay, in this game alone, blocked field goal, blocked punt, which scored. They had a false start on a special teams. They only had 10 guys on the field for the 49ers game-winning field goal. After a timeout. Like, it wasn't even as if it was, you know, rushed up. Substitution screwed up, 10 guys. No, there was a timeout, and you still only got 10 guys on the field for that. Like, what are you doing?
That was bad, man.
Not like people don't know who's on the field goal team. You had, like, a minute of everybody standing around plotting out how you're going to try and block this kick, which is your only chance to not lose this game. And somehow, after that, only 10 dudes roll out there. Where was the 11th guy? Like, what was he doing?
So, yeah, it was horrendous. The Niners did what they could to throw this game away too, man. They did what they could.
Well, Jimmy G specifically.
So it's 7-0 Packers. The Niners are hanging in tough before the half. And didn't this feel like the analytics hate field goals, right, Sam? They hate field goals. But it felt like if the Niners can just kick a field goal to make it 7-3, this feels like a massive win coming out of the first half. And the Niners are driving. They're in field goal range. And I think they got backed up on a play. And if you're watching this, aren't you just like, come on, Jimmy. Jimmy, just don't make any bad decisions.
Yeah.
And he throws out of the pocket an errant pass, intercepted, literally takes 3 points off the board, minimum 3 points off the board for the Niners, which is bad enough. Couple plays later, complete coverage bust, or Aaron Rodgers, just, you know, eye manipulation. Coverage bust, 75-yarder for Aaron Jones. Now it feels like, okay, Jimmy G just made a 6-point mistake. Throws the interception, takes 3 points off the board. Aaron Rodgers gets the ball to Aaron Jones on this busted coverage, 75 yards. Now the Packers are in field goal range, but that's a blocked punt, which of course proves to be, blocked field goal, which of course proves to be one of the biggest plays in the game. So Garoppolo gets away with that a little bit, but the Packers didn't capitalize there.
So right at the start of the game, there was a back-to-back sequence of plays where, like, Jimmy G ironically starts getting let down by his receivers, right? George Kittle just drops a clanger over the middle.
Yes.
Wide open. Could have been a touchdown,
a good throw.
Maybe.
It was a really, good throw.
Really good throw. But, like, not a busted coverage, but the perfect 49ers play, right? The reason that Kyle Shanahan quarterbacks end up leading the league in average yards per attempt is because of plays like this. Completely schemed up. Kittle breaks to the inside against a lone DB. Essentially, if he catches that, it's a foot race. And George Kittle against a guy trying to tackle him one-on-one, there's a reasonable chance that's a touchdown. Instead, stone-handed drop. They go right back to the play over the middle. The next play hits Juwan Jennings, was it, in the hands. Could have caught it, should have caught it.
It was tipped underneath. Just enough.
I think he got to catch that. Anyway, like, two plays back-to-back, guys drop it, Jimmy G doesn't get it. And you're like, from that moment on, it was like Jimmy G's like, all right, if you're going to screw me, I'm going to set screwing you. And it was like creating a teaching tape of throws you can't make. It's anytime he was, like, bothered or wrecked in the pocket, it's like, you know that idea of the 49ers make Jimmy G throw over the middle of the field more than anything else, and that's why he ends up with so many of these, like, why did you throw the ball straight to a linebacker plays? Because he targets that area. Like, that's where they attack. It was almost like this is why. Because if you ask him to throw outside the numbers, he's just, like, lofting up a pass in the general direction of a cornerback and daring the dude to pick it off. It was incredible, the terrible throws that Jimmy G was making in this game.
So I've compared Garoppolo to Tua before, right, and vice versa. Garoppolo doesn't have a great arm. He's got a good enough arm, quick release, gets rid of the ball, all that stuff. I mentioned all those throws he makes under pressure, right? Guys in his face and he can get the throw into the air. But he was throwing late to the flat, which is already a no-no. Right, in Lambeau, like, it's 0 degrees. He probably doesn't have the best velocity on it in these conditions. Those things were like, woo, floating out there. And they didn't come back to bite him.
He got away with a bunch of them.
Yes.
That's like, you know, there's sort of two things that are held up in the, you know, do-nots of quarterback play. One, throw back across your body, you know, generally into the middle of the field. Now, people like Mahomes and Josh Allen, all these quarterbacks recently are kind of breaking that, but generally that's one of the golden do-not-dos of quarterback play. The other one is throw late into the flat, because the cornerbacks are waiting on those, and if you don't absolutely rifle it in there, they're waiting to pick those off. Somehow he got away with it. I just want to jump back for a second to the Green Bay Packers special teams. Now, look, their special teams coordinator is a guy called Morris Drayton, and the man might be a great coach for all I know. I just want to read you a section of his resume because it's pretty hilarious.
Oh, I like when you do the deep research here.
It's pretty funny. So he was a graduate assistant at the Citadel. That's where he got his start. One of my favorite college teams, by the way, just for name alone. It's an awesome name of a school. They should be great based off that.
Sure.
Then he went to the Charleston Swamp Foxes.
Of course.
From there, he went to the...
Cut his teeth with the Swamp Foxes.
Right. Then to the Sinajoki Crocodiles as a defensive coordinator. Big step up. Mm. Then the Goose Creek High School. Then we went to...
Are these lateral moves, or is he moving up and down here?
I don't know what the Sinajoki Crocodiles are, but he was a defensive coordinator there. Then he was an assistant coach at Goose Creek High School. Then we went to South Carolina State, then Coastal Carolina, Southern Miss, the Montreal Alouettes, back to the Citadel. And then somehow we jumped from the Citadel to the Indianapolis Colts and now the Green Bay Packers as a special teams coordinator. What a fascinating resume that is.
It is. Yeah.
You don't see an awful lot of Charleston Swamp Foxes to the NFL. I don't know that they've sent many alumni to the NFL.
There's a reason for that.
Perhaps. That's what I'm saying. I don't know. Like, the man might be a phenomenal special teams mind, for all I know. That being said, that's not the typical pathway your special teams coordinator treads.
Yeah, I have no comment on the coach himself.
On the Swamp Foxes?
Or the Swamp Foxes. don't know enough about the swamp foxes to make an educated statement.
Are foxes typically found in swamps? Aren't they more of like an urban scavenger?
It's a special type of fox.
Special fox. A swamp fox.
Yeah, swamp fox even. I just know the special teams unit was bad.
Terrible. Not just bad.
All year.
Bad doesn't describe it enough. It was horrific. And it cost them the game.
So all that said, it was 10-3.
Yeah.
Green Bay. It's the fourth quarter. There was 4:50 left in the game. 4:50. So the Packers, Eric Armstead with a huge 11-yard sack of Aaron Rodgers on 3rd and 8. I mean, you could blame the special teams all you want, but the Packers offense had a lot of opportunities. They had opportunity after opportunity. All they had to do was put more points on the board. I know there was a blocked field goal in there, but had to just put points on the board. And they kept getting stopped, and the Niners defense did a great job stopping them. 4:50 left. The block punt, which is up in the air seemingly forever, and nobody's even going after the ball. And then the Niners pick it up, run it into the end zone. I did think after that point, like, Aaron Rodgers looked a little rattled. He looked kind of stunned. I don't want to extrapolate this too far. Aaron Rodgers is great. He's got a history of being great. But we have talked about, and I know people think that he's got some of like the most miraculous comebacks of all time. I think, but generally he's been like a step behind some of the other greats when it comes to that stuff. So the stuff we're talking about with like Brady and Burrow, and I didn't think Rodgers, they still had a chance. It was still 10-10, and two quarterbacks had game-winning drive opportunities in this game. And Jimmy Garoppolo was the one who came through in that instance. I thought Rodgers kind of pressed a little bit. They come in, he goes incomplete on an RPO that he holds the ball for like 7 seconds. It's his fault that they picked up an ineligible man downfield penalty when he threw it away. He goes in short pass to Davante Adams, incomplete to Randall Cobb, incomplete to Davante Adams down the field. The incomplete to Cobb could have been a pick six. Rodgers threw the ball late to the flat. I mean, that how would that narrative have been? If that like he throws it late and inside, K'Wan Williams is like kind of right there at the catch point, almost a pick six opportunity. I thought Rodgers kind of folded in the end there when they had an opportunity to bounce back. He looked stunned. I mean, his press conference, he looked stunned too.
He felt like a guy that was getting pretty pissed off at the special teams consistently screwing the team, right? Like,
that and maybe rightfully so.
I mean, look, we're obviously the Irish League is not quite at the NFL level, you know?
Tell me about it, though.
The careers that I and Aaron Rodgers had are slightly different.
Just
right?
Talk about how relatable it was.
Yeah, yeah.
It's 10-10 in Lambeau, 0 degrees, in the snow. That's Aaron Rodgers. Compare your situation to... Yeah, let's get into it.
But as a former football player, I've been on teams where, like, your unit is doing fine and the other unit is not. And when I say not, really not. You know what I mean? And there is a level to which you start to get pretty pissed off at that. You're like, there's only so much we can do over here. You know what I mean? Can you just make a play? Just one. Somewhere. And dig us out of this thing, right? Like, I've been on either side of a 2-0 game, right? And I'm not sure which is more frustrating, but they're both very, very annoying. You know what I mean?
Oh, gosh.
And
you and Aaron Rodgers, you guys should
Right. What I'm saying is I can empathize with the frustration that Rodgers was having in this game of, can you just not have a blocked kick? Just one. Just any of these. You don't make them, right? Any one of them, we'd probably win this game. Just stop getting the kicks blocked. Like, I am struggling over here. All I need you to do is kick the ball over there. How hard is that?
All I'm saying is Patrick Mahomes easily could have had that same attitude, too. He had 13 seconds left down 3 in a really soft defense to throw against. But 13 seconds down 3, and he was like, you know, let's do it.
There's two more things I want to talk about in this game. One, they kept making a big deal early in the game about how much Kyle Shanahan scripts. You know, the famous script. You script the first 15 plays or whatever, and that's how you run an offense.
Yeah.
Shanahan apparently scripts 24 plays and splits them evenly between runs and passes. I'm wondering, as a kind of practical, functional thing, how far do you stick to that script, right? Because the idea generally is you script the first 15 plays on the basis that you can have like a 15-play drive, and you're good, right? Long 15-play drive, opening, touchdown, boom. Great start to the game. And now we get into the flow. If you script 24, how many series do you stick with that before you're like, you know what, the script isn't really working here, but let's junk it? Because like 24 plays can be like the whole half.
Yeah, I don't think
it could be like five series worth.
I feel like we should know this. I'll investigate a little bit further.
I'm just curious, like, but it's how not, many three and outs before you're like, you know what, let's just turn to number 16 in the script.
But like the script is to just it's like an information gathering session, right? It's like, I got to throw all these things out there to see how the defense is going to respond to them, and that'll give us information for further play calling. It also doesn't mean that those 24 in a row, because if you're in the red zone five plays in, your red zone plays are different from your scripted plays. It's got to be, you know, like neutral situation types of plays, like between the 20s, right? I'm assuming you're not going with your, you know, you're not going with your script. What's your... note here? You're not going to read this?
Yeah, there's
oh,
blue,
I see.
There's blue language in there. You can't read that out of the podcast.
Stop sending me notes while I'm talking.
The other thing I wanted to bring up was, you know, coaches are all about the kind of the feels in game, right? That's why they deviate from whatever the analytics tells them. And, you know, you can't tell me that our defense is struggling and that it's a bad weather game and my left guard sucks and whatever. And yet in this game, you decide rather than, like, Green Bay got the ball back and where it looked like they were going to kind of just let it go to the half, right? Mail in the drive, get to halftime, get to the locker room, make the adjustments, do whatever. And then the 49ers took a timeout and were like, oh no, we're not letting you into the halftime locker room. We're going to get the ball back and we're going to score. You essentially just went,
Rodgers. Before the 75-yarder, right?
Yeah. You essentially went, the Green Bay Packers and Aaron Rodgers, one of the greatest quarterbacks to ever play, were essentially mailing in that drive and were willing to dump it and go to the half. And you're like, no, I'm gonna dare Aaron Rodgers to make a play. And then, like, boom, 75-yard. Now, they got away with it, right, because of a blocked kick. But do you really want to dare Aaron Rodgers to make a couple of plays on you before the half? If it was me, not sure I would want to be rolling that dice.
It's actually funny because this, remember the opposite happened in the Super Bowl with Patrick Mahomes, right? The Niners were so afraid of Mahomes, I believe this was the situation, that they didn't call timeouts. Like they didn't, or they ran their offense with the fear of giving the ball back to Mahomes. Because, well,
I mean, look,
they fear Mahomes more than Rodgers.
It was
Rodgers,
a low-scoring game, and you know they weren't. Neither offense was doing an awful lot on the. But it's still Aaron Rodgers. I'm really not sure how much you want to be like poking that bear before halftime. If Rodgers and the Packers are willing to essentially junk their own drive, I would take that as a win and get into the halftime locker room rather than antagonize them and say no, make a play, because they then did, and you almost got punished for it.
All right, here's my high-level thoughts here. Jimmy Garoppolo.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, he didn't play a good game.
No, he didn't. Really didn't.
I didn't think he played a good game last week against the Cowboys.
Also didn't.
All I know is the 49ers, this offseason, went to great lengths, multiple first-round picks, to trade up and get Jimmy Garoppolo's replacement. And he has only been the starter for two full seasons.
Oh, God.
And in both full seasons, he's made it to the NFC Championship. Of course, the first one was the Super Bowl.
Uh-huh.
This one's the NFC Championship. And look, again, like I'll read my tweet from the other day because this is my thought. I'm merely stating a fact. I don't have to read the tweet. I mean, that's the fact I'm stating. The 2 years that Jimmy Garoppolo has been the starter from start to finish, the Niners have been to the NFC Championship at least. The first one was a Super Bowl. That's the fact. Mm-hmm. I'm just stating that fact.
Yeah.
Right, I'm not saying it's because of QB wins. I'm not saying it's because of Jimmy Garoppolo. I'm not saying anything. I'm just saying it is fascinating to me that the Niners spent this offseason finding a Jimmy Garoppolo replacement with massive investment, but when he's on the field, they win a lot. Now, is that because C.J. Beathard and Nick Mullins are terrible?
Talk about the number one graded quarterback in the NFL this year.
C.J. Beathard was incredible. I mean, he just developed under Urban Meyer.
Three throws,
95 grade for C.J. Beathard. Great development under Urban Meyer, who gets a bad rap for not developing C.J. Beathard the way that he did. I did think a big part of the trade up was because coming into the year, Jimmy Garoppolo had played 48% of the games in which he was supposed to start. I did think it was as much his durability as his performance, right? That they were equal parts in why the Niners wanted to move on. But do you read this as, and one more thing, this is Kyle Shanahan's first hand-picked quarterback. The first quarterback that he handpicked was Jimmy Garoppolo. They traded for him. They signed him to a massive contract. First handpicked quarterback. His second handpicked quarterback is Trey Lance. So does this mean Kyle Shanahan, give him Jimmy Garoppolo or better, and that dude's just going to win? Ridiculous. You know, crazy town. They're going to be in the mix as long as his starting quarterback's healthy. Or that, you know, Trey Lance, if he develops, is going to take this offense to the next level. Like, how do you read that? Because I'm just stating facts here. When Jimmy Garoppolo is on the football field, the 49ers win 70%+ of their games, which is at the same level as Rodgers and some of these other top quarterbacks.
Yeah. I think Kyle Shanahan's offense is generally a massive signal booster for quarterback play. So Nick Mullins has some numbers to put him on like a graphic with Andrew Luck and Patrick Mahomes, right? The idea, like, Nick Mullins is one of the most productive quarterbacks on a like per game basis in NFL history. But Nick Mullins is not a good quarterback. C.J. Beathard was able to have success. Like, this offense makes quarter, like, exactly that throw we were talking about, the first quarter to George Kittle. That could easily have been like a 70 whatever yard touchdown for an expected throw from the quarterback, right? It was a nice throw. Put it where it should have been. The Kittle dropped it. But like, you would expect every single quarterback in the NFL to make that throw routinely. Those are there all the time in this offense. That's what happens. I also think that Jimmy G is better than those other guys and making most of those throws. But like, George tweeted this last night, that Jimmy G in his last four games has 10 turnover-worthy plays. And I think that's being kind to some of those ones late in the flat in this game, which probably weren't turnover-worthy, but were like, let's say, tempting fate, and two big-time throws. But he's won three games. Like, there's a degree to which this offense is succeeding in spite of Jimmy G. He hasn't been punished as much for those turnover-worthy plays as he could, probably should have been. And I was wondering at some point during this game where they were, like, struggling through the sequence of, like, Jimmy G prayers to the flat. We were like, what is he there for? Like, the only reason we're not starting Trey Lance right now is because we don't think Trey Lance is capable of reining in the mistake plays, right? We think he's not quite ready. He's gonna throw a bad pass, and that's going to put us in a hole. Well, like, Jimmy G's out here doing that as well. Like, what's the difference? Trey Lance will at least bring some, A, big-time throw capability, and B, threat with his legs. Like, there's upside to him as well as the downside. So if Jimmy G is going to provide the downside as well, why are we not starting him? So I kind of think that at this point,
why is there at least not a Trey Lance package in there? I keep asking myself.
Right. I think at this point, they are kind of riding their luck a little bit in terms of getting away with the mistakes that Jimmy G is making. Now, okay, a lot of the time he makes some good things happen as well, but like, at some point, you can't keep pitching the ball to the defense.
I also want to say, Garoppolo was good in 2019, 13th graded quarterback, but they also won an NFC championship with him throwing the ball 8 times.
Yes.
And they also, in the Super Bowl,
and that was like the game plan here as well. He had 23 dropbacks.
Yeah, and in the Super Bowl, couple missed throws, especially the one, the deep post. That Niners are Super Bowl champs if he hits one of those throws,
yes.
Right? But that fine of a line. It's just a fascinating discussion.
Also, remember, I mean, this is a good team. Like, preseason, this was a team a lot of people liked before injuries hit them and derailed the whole thing. It's
sure.
Not quite as good as it was a couple of years ago, but this is still a team that it belongs in the NFC Championship game. I know it looks like the odd one out because of the quarterback, but this team, I think, is worthy of being in the final four NFL teams. It's not like this isn't a sort of fraudulent side that's just managed to roll there through luck. It is a good team, a really special offense, potentially. I know they only put up 13 points, but like, just unique and the weapons they can deploy and the offensive line and all these kinds of things. It's a schematically smart team and a very good group, and they deserve to be there. So, like, you know, you do just need a quarterback that isn't going to screw it up. By the way, did you also see that play? I know you saw it because I sent it to you. Where they put Trent Williams in motion.
That was where I was going next. Yeah, everybody was talking about it, Sam, not just you.
No, it was just me. I saw it on the replay.
I'm also torn on this. Yeah, the offense scored 6 points in this game. The offense scored 6 points. I mean, that would be your argument against Jimmy Garoppolo in general, because I don't think we're overrating Kyle Shanahan and his genius and all that stuff, but the offense still scored only 6 points. But little stuff like putting Trent Williams, the best tackle in football, in motion, not just in motion, but snapping the ball while he's in motion,
yeah,
running power behind him on a toss play was fantastic. They ran it again the second time. They ran power more downhill. It didn't work. Everybody's like, "What's that play call?" Like, the people that were complaining about the play call, I think were just. I mean, it was power behind a motioning Trent Williams. That was fine.
How is this not, like, football has been, this is a game that's existed for like 100 years. How is this the first time somebody's thought to do that?
I mean, presumably somebody in the single wing era did it.
But like, and people recently have done it with like tight ends, and the Ravens have done it with Patrick Ricard, the fullback. But like, how has nobody thought before to just, you take your left tackle, you make him the tight end on that side, and you put that dude in motion. And instead of like a pull block where the guy can only start moving post-snap, you know, he's got to take that little step backwards to get himself some space and then start looping around. You literally just have this guy sprint in motion across the formation so that when the ball is snapped, he's about to bury the defensive end on that side, and there's nothing that guy can do about it.
This is why I can't believe they're not using Trey Lance for 8 to 10 plays a game. I can't believe it.
Like, the guy that he made contact with was Rashawn Gary, who, by the way, was fantastic in this game.
Yeah.
Like, almost unblockable. Rashawn Gary is like 280 pounds, and you're like, oh, that poor guy. He has, like, he's like a car on the train tracks, just getting annihilated by the intercity that, like, blasts through him. Like, a 280-pound dude was literally cannon fodder for in-motion Trent Williams on that play.
So think about all this, right? They're playing, we've used the phrase positionless football before. They've got a tackle as a moving H-back, basically.
Yes.
They ran that formation earlier this year. I can't even remember the exact breakdown, but basically a receiver was playing tight end. The fullback was playing receiver. The receiver was playing running back. I mean, Debo was in the backfield. Juszczyk was out wide. Ayuk had his hand in the dirt like a tight end. They're breaking positional football rules, which is a big part of Debo Samuel and all that stuff, which, by the way, that's the other part of this. To set up...
Debo's so good.
He is so good. To set up the game-winning field goal, they go 3rd and 7, trap play. Same thing that they used Raheem Mostert a couple years ago to break off a long touchdown against the Packers. Trap play, and Debo just runs through contact, man. He is a special, special player. You just don't find receivers. I do remember, I forget the exact note that I wrote down with him in college, scouting, just being like the tenacity, like the way he runs after the catch, he is just getting after it. Like, the dude just plays hard, and I think that is one of those traits that does translate to him as a running back. But Debo picks up the first down, and that set up the Robbie Gould game-winning field goal. But
he averaged 3 yards per carry after contact, which is like a Derrick Henry number.
Yeah, I mean, the Packers did as well as they could against the run.
The dude was banged up. Like, he took a shot to the ribs in that game. He was hobbled after the big play that he made. Like, he was fighting through some pain and still did what he does.
Yeah, he was incredible. I got to the point, he looked like he was in so much pain. I think I texted you about Alex. Like, remember, we were so afraid of Alex Smith taking a hit when he came back? That's what I felt about Debo, but he took the hits. He was great. So that's all I want to say about Trey Lance. I can't believe they're not using Trey Lance because of this positional football, this positionless football stuff, and just putting the defense in a bind. Are they going to unleash him at some point? Because, despite their history against the Rams, I think they're going to have to score a lot of points against the Rams. They got to pull out everything they can to beat the Rams and then, the Chiefs or the Bengals, whatever it is, if they're going to win a Super Bowl. But
it does seem weird that they're not using him at all. Like, they went, I mean, early in the season, he was on the field for like 5 snaps a game doing, short yardage or whatever. And then all of a sudden it was like, nope, no more. She's not going to play. Like, if we need him, if Jimmy G's hurt, he'll start. But after that,
Lance
he's on the sideline.
He is a dynamic runner.
Yeah.
And the starts that he had when he got out of the pocket, he is out of the pocket in a hurry on those rollouts, and he opens up the field. Like, you have to cover the whole field when Trey Lance is out there, which is what the Niners do offensively. That is how they play the game, which is like, here, cover every inch of grass, figure it out. And Trey Lance does help that. So I'm interested to see if they do every single week. We're gonna ask for it. We're halfway through. We're on pace for the we'll be under 3 hours here. This makes up. We left a half hour on the table in the preview show. This makes up for it. Only four teams remain in the NFL playoffs, and that means only four teams left for you to bet at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. We're counting down to Super Bowl 56, and new customers can get 56-1 odds on any team. You bet just $5 and get $280 in free bets if your team wins. If you're not a new customer, that's fine. You can experience the conference championships with same-game parlays. You can combine multiple bets from the same game for a bigger payout. The more legs you add, the more money you can win. DraftKings is safe, secure, and reliable. Best of all, you can deposit and withdraw your cash whenever you want. So download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now. Use promo code PFF and get 56-1 odds on any NFL team. Bet just $5 and win $280 in free bets if your team wins. It's promo code PFF for 56-1 odds at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. Must be 21 or older, New Jersey, Indiana, or Pennsylvania only. New customers only. Minimum $5 deposit, $1 wager required, one per customer. Restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for details. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. We're on to Sunday's games. Rams 30, Bucks 27. Crazy game. It was 27-3, Rams.
Yeah.
Everybody's making their 28-3 jokes. Get it to 28-3. Tom Brady's got you right where he wants you and all that stuff.
And it looked like a game where you're like, there's no comeback happening here. No. Like, even if the Bucks offense somehow manages to just execute some plays and move the ball and actually get some points on the board, like, their defense can't stop anything. Like, this was it really didn't look like there's any way back in this game for Tampa Bay. And then all of a sudden the Rams were just like, no, just take as many turnovers as you need. We'll make this close. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. This was nuts. I mean, I mentioned on the PFF NFL Daily where we just gave a quick reaction. We tried to, you know, take this whole weekend and react in 12 minutes at the high level stuff. This was, you know, the Falcons 28-3 comeback had some, you know, defensive plays in there and stops and all that stuff. But that was Brady leading a ridiculous comeback with a little bit of help. This was the Rams trying to throw the game away.
Yeah.
With a bad snap. Cam Akers fumble, which again, you know, Ndamukong Suh forces it. Cam Akers fumble, however you want.
Two different fumbles from Akers, though.
Two different fumbles from Akers, right. I mean, there was the one at the very end that gave the Bucks the chance to tie it up.
Cooper Kupp fumble.
Like, Cooper Kupp fumble.
Throwing the ball away.
The Cam Akers fumble before the half took at least 3 points off the board.
Mm-hmm.
Because he fumbles, the Bucks recover, and, you know, just the Rams just didn't get a field goal opportunity. And then at the end of the day, the play call that's going to be discussed would be discussed like crazy if you didn't have an even, you know, crazier game happen after it. Todd Bowles, zero blitz. Matthew Stafford throws it up to Cooper Kupp, hits him in stride to get into field goal range. They run down with no timeouts left, mind you. Rams run down, spike it, kick the game-winning field goal. And this was the tweet I got right. Too much time left for Cooper Kupp, who on the last two plays, as I mentioned on the daily, in man coverage, made his defender fall, and then ran by the defense for the 70-yarder to set up the game-winning field goal.
Yeah, I this game was really interesting because Tristan Wirfs didn't go at all. So we made this point in the preview show that like the health of Tristan Wirfs is going to be a really important thing because Brady, the least pressured quarterback in the NFL over the course of the regular season. And we saw immediately Tristan Wirfs gets hurt against the Eagles. And in that game, he wasn't just pressured, he was sacked four times. So, like, that's a really stark example of just how fragile that whole thing is, right? You go from the best pass blocking in the NFL or one of the best to your right tackle's hurt and all of a sudden you're just getting buried by you know, a decent defensive front, but certainly one that the Rams can match. Wirfs didn't go at all. High ankle sprain is usually a thing that keeps a guy out for a while. So Josh Wells starts. And Josh Wells was not 100% healthy either. That guy had been on the injury report all week with a quad injury or something. I think he hyperextended his knee last week in the game as well. There were plays in this game where you're like, that guy's hobbled. Like, he can't, he's not right. Like, this is not good. So very quickly, the Bucks realized that, like, okay, we need to help him out basically every single play. Like, we got to put all the help on that side. And the Rams, I think, were doing so. The upshot of all this is Brady's under more pressure in this game than he's typically used to. And his average time to throw was like 2.2 seconds, which is about as fast as it gets. Pretty low average depth of target, but we're just trying to survive here because the line is getting its ass kicked. And then the Rams on defense, I think we're doing really smart things to maximize how big of a problem that was for Tampa Bay. So Aaron Donald was spending a few snaps matched up on the edge and just like running through Wells. But they were also, I think, so you would think that, okay, we got a weak link on that side. Let's put Von Miller there, our best pass rusher, and just have Von Miller destroy this guy one-on-one. But I think the Rams realized that, you know what, we can win against this guy with people that aren't Von Miller. So what if we put Von Miller on the other side? Now knowing that all of the help is going to be on Wells, and that means Von Miller is going to be one-on-one with Donovan Smith basically the whole game.
Yeah.
So as big a problem as Wells was, and it was probably the biggest problem that they had because it meant they needed to help him out basically every snap, the bigger impact was arguably made by Donovan Smith getting wrecked by Von Miller because he's one-on-one the whole time, and they need him to hold up because they don't have any help anymore. All the help is on the other side of the line. So all of a sudden, the Rams are just like three-fifths of that offensive line is getting beaten because you've got Wells needing help every play. You've got Donovan Smith getting wrecked by Von Miller. And you've got Aaron Donald just destroying whoever he's lining up against on the inside because he's Aaron Donald. And then, like, so this was like, I mean, I was asking you yesterday, when was the last time Brady was dealing with this big a problem on the offensive line? It's a long time ago.
It was a Von Miller game. It was the 2015.
15? That's like 6 years ago.
It was the 2015 AFC Championship. That was the worst offensive line. Maybe we don't have Brady's early career, but maybe probably the worst offensive line Brady played behind that year in 2015. And that was the game where the Broncos shut down the Patriots offense. They won 20-18 going to the Super Bowl. That was probably the last time Brady was under – no, it wasn't the last time he was under pressure 40-plus percent of the time. The Eagles, actually, in the Super Bowl where he threw for 500, the Eagles pressured over 40% of the time in that Super Bowl as well. But this felt like the this felt similar to that no-fly zone Broncos defense as far as pressure and coverage working together. And, I just think at the end of the day, the Bucs being depleted with their original receiving core – and on the offensive line was too much. The Rams just dominated up front. Brady, during the regular season, had been hit while throwing. So we classify all these incompletion types. Hit while throwing to force an incompletion, right, where your arm gets hit and all that stuff one time all regular season. I don't have the official number here. It had to at least be four in this game that where Brady was hit in his throwing motion to force an incompletion. So, and then he just... when he did have a clean pocket, was a little fidgety, right? Like, you're still kind of feeling it.
Which is, yeah. We talked about that, like, so much that...
But that's also, like, if your first read's not there, okay, get into that second read, like, you're rushed. And Brady was either under pressure or rushed pretty much every... like, his own doing, rushed on every drop back.
Yeah, that's the impact of pressure. It's why it's so much more important than just, like, getting... you know, obviously, every time you rush, you want to get a sack. But pressure makes an impact... that resonates beyond just the play. Like, Brady for the regular season was the only quarterback in the NFL pressured on less than 20% of his dropbacks. So one in five, less than one in five, he's feeling pressure. In this game, it was 44% of the time. So more than twice as often as he's typically pressured was how much he was getting pressured in this game, and almost one in every two dropbacks in this game. And that means that, okay, for those 44% of the dropbacks, you are under pressure. You actually have to get the ball out or adjust or do whatever you do. But it means that, like, if literally every other play you're getting pressure, the play you're not getting pressure, you're probably thinking it's coming. So there was like one play late in the game where he had time to find the dude and was just, yeah, it's coming. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You can't stop. You can't turn that off. Once you're deep in the game and you've been feeling pressure the entire time, you expect it. Even when it's not there, your brain is just anticipating that heat is coming, and you can't simply switch that off for the one clean pocket you get in the critical situation to find the dude that's open.
I also thought, you know, we talked about it before the game. Okay, Tristan Wirfs is out. How do the Bucks balance this? And my prediction was more 13 personnel, so more three tight end sets. And I think we saw that. I thought the Bucks, in that respect, did a pretty good job of putting more tight ends on the field because they have three to work with Gronk, Cameron Brait, and O.J. Howard. So they did that a little bit. I also thought they'd run more play action. They only ran like 5% play action rate. But one of them was Brady turns his back, and then Donovan Smith blindside, there's a strip sack by Von Miller. So maybe that's why they didn't want to do that. But I thought the play action game, the Bucs use less play action. They're like at the bottom three in the NFL. I thought they'd use more play action just to slow down the rush a little bit, and they didn't. And I don't know if they got a little gun-shy just because of the strip sack or what, but I thought that was one way to maybe slow down the rush, or if you just don't want Brady to turn his back to the defense because they might be on you in 2 seconds.
I'm also surprised that they didn't lean more on Leonard Fournette in the game. Lenny. Obviously had two rushing touchdowns, but 13 carries for 51 yards in total. Early in the game, like any first down they were picking up was Fournette.
Couple big runs.
Yeah. He had 9 catches, I think, as well. Like he was a big part of the offense, and obviously when you go down by 24 points, like the game script is kind of going out the window and you can't necessarily just lean. But like for a big portion of this game, they simply were not, there was no offense. Like they could not function. And the only thing that was working was Leonard Fournette. And on the ground, like the more you run the ball, the less you're exposing Brady to pressure and these hits and all those kinds of things. I was a little bit surprised that they weren't more determined to feature him as the thing that the offense was based on, but they were apparently comfortable in letting Brady do that.
All right, we'll circle back a little bit to the Bucs offense when we talk comeback. But the Rams got up early because they were pretty much unstoppable offensively, and then when it seemed like the Bucs might have a stop, 3rd and 20, and call it a coverage bust, call it Stafford's eye manipulation, call it whatever you want.
Look, it's time to have an intervention for Dano. Dano, buddies with Matthew Stafford, former teammates, the backup quarterback to Stafford. Dano sees no wrong in anything Stafford ever does. He's the greatest quarterback of all time. He's the man's hero. It's bless him, right? It's sweet. It's quaint. It's nice, you know? But it's not accurate. It's not, you know, actual football analysis. So when you've got plays like this, it's like complete coverage breakdown in the Bucs defense. They're running Tampa 2, and the safety basically he gets caught going to the inside receiver. The outside receiver is just left wide the hell open down the sideline, and it's a huge play. And everyone's like, oh, look at that coverage bust in the defense. Dano's like, sorry, I respectfully disagree. This is not a coverage bust. This is Stafford making magic happen with his eyes. You're like, look, every coverage bust is forced in some way. You know what I mean? Like, they don't just randomly run to the wrong spot on the field. There's something about the offensive play that causes the bust, you know? That doesn't stop it being a coverage bust. That's why, like, literally, the idea that somebody is not covering like a receiver makes it a bust. That's what it is. You can't be like, nah, that's not a coverage bust. That's Stafford.
It's also really interesting because you had a bunch of NFL safeties being like, nah, it's just bad safety play. Just bad safety play. Right. So, like, how do you define
a coverage? And by the way, like, this is not a complicated. It's the specific coverage we're running here. It's Tampa 2, right?
So
we're not running the most exotic thing in the world here.
Right.
There's fairly established rules about this thing.
The safety is supposed to split the two verticals, and then, you know, you generally have enough time to react to the ball in the air, right? You see the quarterback throw, you react to the ball in the air because it's going to be 40 yards down the field. Edwards was well out of position. and it's a wide open.
And yes, Stafford.
This was the 70-yard touchdown. Sorry, this wasn't the 70. The Cooper Kupp one was not 70. Before.
And yes, Stafford did look him off. Like Stafford's eyes were middle slash, you know, leaning left to try and get the safety over there. He did manipulate him. On the other hand, like this is standard practice for quarterbacks. Like you're not, like that's. You're not necessarily supposed to have your eyes purely on the quarterback as a deep high, you know, deep half safety in Tampa 2. You're supposed to be aware of the fact that, like, there's two routes heading vertically in your general direction. You need to be involved in both of them because you're playing the deep half. Like, this is not the first thing, the first time this has ever happened. This is relatively routine. So, yeah, Stafford made a great play, but it was a coverage bust.
Yeah, it was. But that was a massive play in the game. Look, I thought Stafford played a really good game. Now, all that said, he was really good early. He did throw a pass in the end zone that
was
dropped.
That pass?
I don't know because the receiver ran a dig, and it looked like he was throwing a curl, but there was no reason to throw a curl.
Yeah, and it was one of those ones that was so off.
It was behind by 3 yards.
Yeah. Which, and it was like a red zone play, right?
So, yes, it would have been an interception in the end zone.
But I mean, just in terms of the ball wasn't traveling a long way
sure. For
you to be 3 yards off. You know
right.
what I mean? Like that, it was so far off that my default assumption is that's not just an inaccurate throw. That's some form of weird breakdown from communication standpoint, right? I generally assume that an NFL quarterback is not missing a 15-yard throw by 3 yards of accuracy for no reason, which is the alternative to that suggestion. So, you know, somebody at some point tweeted me in the game that, like, oh, Stafford hasn't had the meltdown throw yet. And I was like, well, he did. He just had it in the first quarter, and the Bucs didn't come up with it.
This is all we're saying, like, when we're grading every play on every play, every player on every play, like, you're not having the same emotional reaction to the dropped interception. Or the narrative's going to change.
Well, you literally forget about it. Like, people
yes.
come away from that game, they're like, oh, Stafford hasn't had the bad throw yet. Like, it happened.
Now,
like,
was that officially – and then he almost fumbled at the on the last play. I think they ruled it a fumble on
they?
The last drive.
Have you checked?
I haven't officially checked.
Let me check.
We have breaking news, though, because we do have astute listeners
yeah.
and viewers, really, who are watching us live. Drew Forsyth has already emailed us with an answer to the Swamp Fox, Sam.
The answer, what was the question?
Well, we asked what a swamp fox is.
Oh.
Remember?
Yes.
We have an answer. The swamp fox, you'll like this, was a Revolutionary War figure who ran a guerrilla-style campaign in the South.
It's not even an animal. It's a person.
Yeah. His name was Francis Marion, and he was depicted in a 1959 TV series by Leslie Nielsen.
Really?
and Drew goes on to say, who was in The Naked Gun?
He was.
Obviously, as your trivia specialty, you know that Leslie Nielsen was in The Naked Gun. But thank you, Drew. That was great. Well done. And I don't know if this was just common knowledge by Drew or if this was like, hey, I'm going to search this right now.
Known for his cunning and resourcefulness.
How about that?
Huh. All right.
Leslie Nielsen depicting the Swamp Fox back in the late 50s.
A little part of me is disappointed that it's not an actual animal. There you go. Look, it's a pretty cool logo. I like that.
Okay, we're getting that.
We're getting the Swamp Fox's hoodie?
Yeah, you need a Swamp Fox's hoodie.
Swamp Fox's hoodie.
Yes. For Packers special teams.
Good for them. It's not ruled a fumble. It was just a sack.
Okay. Great. So that would have hurt his grade even further.
Yeah, but like that was another one where it's like, you know, Stafford is threatening to do something terrible. But like the intercept or the bad throw. You can literally pause that play. There's a frame where the ball is in the hands of the safety. You know what I mean? So, like, that changes everything. All of a sudden, Stafford does pitch the ball right to the defense, and we're like, oh, there it is. There's Stafford having a meltdown again. But
yeah,
they didn't come up with it. So we don't – like, literally, people completely forget that play happened.
So I think the Rams completely dominated up front, right? So at the same time – you have Josh Wells struggling in a backup role, and the Rams are the Bucs offensive line is getting whooped. Chris, the boss, Joseph Noteboom, Joe Noteboom on the other side, did a really nice job. Now he's facing JPP,
right?
Who is he's not a good pass rusher.
Certainly not anymore.
This like, he used to be good.
Game, playoff game he'd lost?
Yeah, he was.
Was it 9-0 or 7-0? He'd never.
Yeah, because he was part of those Eli teams that only won.
Right.
In the Super Bowl. I mean, the one
Bucks last year.
Like, the Bucks last year.
Dude, it was the first time he's lost.
Dominant playoff player, JPP.
Now we got Ben Stockwell chiming in on the Swamp Foxes. The Swamp Fox, brackets the guy, was one of the inspirations for Mel Gibson's character in that awful movie, The Patriot, is what Ben says.
What?
What?
He didn't like The Patriot?
Patriot was terrible. What are you talking about?
Patriot was solid.
Patriot was awful.
It was no Braveheart. Did you like Braveheart?
Yeah, Braveheart was good.
Oh, okay.
Patriot was terrible.
Just because it was...
They were equally, like, historically inaccurate, but Braveheart was at least cool.
You were biased across the pond.
In the British Isles.
In the British Isles.
Austin, it turns out, needs your diagram. We need to find it again for him. He's just...
What does he think? You're over, like... Like Far East or something?
He was
like
blown
that?
Up. He couldn't understand, I think, that Ireland was different from the UK. He didn't understand. He hasn't had your diagram. That's all I'm saying.
We all just need to be educated.
That's true.
I don't mean to derail this any further.
Yeah?
Because this certainly would have. But there was... I didn't get to my big Packers take. I don't know if we have to save this. It's from Bucky Brooks. And I feel like the Wednesday show, or maybe a daily... We could go through Bucky Brooks' entire timeline because it's interesting. I respect Bucky, right? He comes from a
scouting. We're always looking for new video ideas in the PFF channel. It'd just be you scrolling through Bucky's timeline.
All I'm saying is if you're looking for the Final Four narrative stuff that I was talking about, Bucky's timeline
is just the narrative in a nutshell.
I mean, it's just like, let this be a lesson that you need to draft athletes. Let this be a lesson that your special teams matters. And he's got it like this historical Packers take about the way their team is built. I don't think we can squeeze it into the show.
Okay.
Should I read it anyway, though, now that I've...
I mean, if it's short, if we've got to spend...
We've got to push this discussion somewhere else. But from 1939 to 2001,
yeah,
at Packers, he tags the Packers.
Of course.
We're 14-0 at home in the playoffs. But they're 7-7 at Lambeau, per Pro Football Talk, who did all the research there. Got to wonder if their playing style is best suited for cold weather. Lombardi's squad were smash-mouth units built on Packer sweep and defense. Just a thought. Thinky face emoji. So... So Bucky's just throwing it out there. Maybe the Brett Favre, Aaron Rodgers Packers were not equipped to win in Lambeau like Lombardi's squad.
Huh.
So all I'm saying is Bucky...
Didn't Brett Favre...
I'm not going to sit here and trash Bucky Brooks.
Favre was like undefeated at Lambeau for years until Vic beat him.
Until Michael Vick rolled in. I'm not going to sit here and trash Bucky Brooks and his takes or whatever. All I'm saying is it's an interesting thought exercise because... I also think he was the one who tweeted, you can win with a non-elite quarterback here in 2017 NFL, right? I mean, it might be worth maybe our Wednesday show or something going through all of the Final Four assumptions that have been made here when every single game came down to a field goal. I mean, if the Titans game goes the other way, it's like, let this be a lesson. You need a 250-pound running back named Derrick Henry. Like, you know what I mean? It's going both ways here.
Wasn't this the one game where you're like, If it wasn't as close as the final score, the final score flattered Tampa Bay here. Like, somehow they got back into this, they tied it up, and then the Rams ended up winning anyway. But, like, this should have been a beatdown.
Yeah,
they were annihilating Tampa Bay and then were the architect of the comeback themselves by throwing the ball away a million times. Now, ironically, it wasn't Stafford doing it because... This is the thing we've been saying, is like, can you weather the inevitable Stafford meltdown that seems to happen every couple of games, right? So far, hasn't happened in the playoffs. Stafford has won his first two playoff games ever, and personally has played a reasonably clean brand of football. Now, as we say, there was that throw to a safety in the end zone, which would have changed things. But that was it, right? One bad play, the last drive, that almost fumble, could have also been catastrophic as well. But generally... Stafford played pretty damn well in this game.
Yes.
It was everybody else tossing the ball away. So you come out of this and you're like, all right, if you rerun that game five times, the Rams win by an average of like 15 points, right?
Yeah. And I think you know, Brady makes the 55-yard touchdown to Mike Evans, which was a fantastic throw, but very much of this comeback was Rams-driven.
Yeah.
So as much as I'm talking about Bucky and extrapolating into this Final Four and all that stuff, I do think it's fair analysis to look at the Rams, who we dissected probably more than any team as far as their strategy goes this offseason and in season, and say this is paying off for the Rams. Now, of course, you would, you know, you could say, look, it's got to be Super Bowl or bust, and if they lose one of the next two games, hey, they just threw two picks away for Von Miller. But like, from a team building standpoint, is this not worth it? And maybe that's part of the Wednesday show as well. We get into that much further.
It's paying off, right? But the whole point is the whole thing is sort of designed on winning them a Super Bowl this year. But so far, it's very difficult to argue with the success of the very clear strategy that this team has had, which is A, we trade for proven NFL quality assets because we think those are more valuable than like the lottery ticket of the draft. And B, we stuff all of our eggs into a very small number of baskets, right? So our team is essentially constructed around five players. We have Matthew Stafford. We have Cooper Kupp. We have Aaron Donald. We have Jalen Ramsey. And then we bring in Von Miller to make the fifth. Okay, there's some other important players as well, like Andrew Whitworth has been a rock for them, but Whitworth didn't play in this game. Odell Beckham was a big thing as well, replacing some of the production from Robert Woods and some of that role as well. But generally, we're talking about like five guys versus a game day active roster of 45. Really small number of important players. All of those five are playing well right now, right?
Yeah.
Von Miller just had one of his best pass rushing games ever. Like, finally looked like old Von Miller, like unstoppable rush threat. He's been an elite run defender the whole way, but this was him as good as he's ever been as a pass rusher. Aaron Donald is just a freaking wrecking ball inside. Matthew Stafford has had those clean games and shown really big plays in key moments in those two playoff games. Jalen Ramsey, all right, whooped on the touchdown. Outside of that, was causing real problems in terms of taking away Mike Evans and forcing Brady to go somewhere else. Like, generally speaking, the whole idea of what they're doing, piling all these resources into a really small concentration of people, it's working. And that's something that like people have been hating on for a while. Now, does it all fall to pieces if one of those guys gets injured? Maybe. But right now, it's a gamble that's paying off.
Yeah, it is. So especially the in-season pickups of Von Miller and OBJ, they're both playing well. They're both making massive contributions. Von Miller, we said at the time, he's the best edge rusher that has ever played with Aaron Donald. Yeah. In a game like
even
yesterday.
Now, like even his current state of Von Miller.
Yeah. Current Von Miller, which is a declining,
right,
later career Von Miller, though he didn't look like it yesterday. He looked like 2015 Von yesterday against Donovan Smith. That makes them so dangerous in a game like this. And so in these games where we're talking about, hey, the defensive fronts did a really nice job. This was another one where the Rams defensive front did so much. And then I think there are some disingenuous Stafford equals Goff takes out there because they're comparing Stafford to Goff was pretty good in 2017, but especially like in 2018. But there's something different. Remember, what was Goff's kryptonite in 2018? What was the Rams' kryptonite in 2018? The zero blitz, right? Uh-huh. There's cover four. There's two coverages, cover four, quarters, and zero blitz, right? So when you talk about, I mean, people are throwing EPA numbers out there, right? Yeah, Goff's was the same as Stafford's this year and that year, whatever. When it came down to crunch time, Jared Goff, zero blitz in the Super Bowl, throws a pick to Stephon Gilmore when they're driving. In this game, Todd Bowles, for some reason, draws up a zero blitz when the Rams have no timeouts and have one shot to get into field goal range. Zero blitz. Stafford recognizes, puts it up early, puts it on Cooper Kupp's hands. It was fantastic. I just thought, clearly, Matthew Stafford has upgraded this Rams offense. Now, it doesn't mean Matthew Stafford has played maybe at the same level as the very elite quarterbacks in the NFL, but he has upgraded this offense from where it was the last couple of years and even overall, I think, where it was in 2018. If for nothing else, Stafford has the high-end games in him, and this overall felt like really good Stafford outside of maybe like a throw or two in this game.
Yeah, it was.
So the Rams' moves are paying off is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And it is part of this storyline. And good on Stafford for making those throws when he needed to.
Right. And the Stafford narrative is fascinating because it's kind of up in the air right now, right? The Dano people, the like Stafford is the new Messiah. He is the religion that we shall convert to. Those people were taking victory laps after like 5 weeks of the season. Everyone else is an idiot. And then Stafford went on that meltdown run. And then the opposite people were taking victory laps. Ah, you guys, Stafford is who he's always been, which is to say a guy that's going to throw the game away at the crunch time. And now we're somewhere in the middle, right? Stafford hasn't been scintillating. He's not like absolutely torching the place. He's not playing like Joe Burrow or Mahomes or Josh Allen right now. But neither is he throwing the game away. So right now we're like plotting the middle course of this is kind of probably where the Rams expected this to land, which is he's an upgrade over Jared Goff, right? Even 2018 Goff, the grades might be the same ballpark, but they're comprised in a different way. It's like Roethlisberger was one of the worst graded quarterbacks in the NFL this year. But in crunch time, late in the game, with a drive on the line, you knew that Roethlisberger was better than like Jared Goff and a bunch of the other guys that he was around, right? Because he has that veteran savvy and the ability to pull out the right play at the right time. Stafford is similar, right? Like that last play, okay, looked like a pretty terrible defensive call. We're going to zero blitz. We're going to send the slot corner. I'm going to leave Cooper Kupp one-on-one with a safety downfield. Right? All right. On the other hand, Stafford still needs to hang in there with Ndamukong Suh, a guy who had literally said earlier in the game, I will fuck you up. Like,
direct you know, quote.
Right. Quote. Like, we saw that, the lip reading 101 when they were getting into it. That's what he told him. Like, that dude is barreling down towards you. And let's face it, Ndamukong Suh's got a history of, you know, doing some pretty questionable things during or after the play. So that guy is barreling towards you at a rate of knots, and you have to hang in there and fire the ball downfield to hit that guy for the game-winning touchdown with not an awful lot of time left on the clock. So is that a throw Jared Goff makes? Probably not.
Like certainly not against a zero blitz. That's not Goff's forte.
Right. So those are the plays that Stafford is making right now, even if you know he's not one of the best graded quarterbacks in the NFL. Like that's what they traded for.
Think of this from a narrative standpoint too, though, right? We've talked a lot about the McVay offense and needing to take the next step. And when you look back historically, again, against in those specific situations, his kryptonite, whether it's McVay or Goff, the kryptonite has been zero blitz. It has been quarters. Even just in that like microcosm of the you know of the whole thing, if the Rams found answers to these certain ways that defenses attack them, then the Stafford upgrade maybe is worth it, right? Just because they're able to,
yeah,
right? When like last year when the Dolphins just blitzed the heck out of Goff and he, you know, couldn't do anything with it, or the offense couldn't do anything with it, it's no longer a weakness, right? So now defenses have to attack differently.
I mean, it was hyper expensive, but like if they almost won a Super Bowl with Jared Goff, right? If the difference between winning a Super Bowl and not is the difference between Matthew Stafford and Jared Goff, which might be a smaller upgrade than most people expected it to be, but is still an upgrade. Like, if that is the difference between winning a ring and not, wasn't it worth it for them?
Let me find the PFF WAR numbers here, because if we're going to use, we can use a number just to quantify wins really quickly. Goff last year was worth 1.46 wins for the Rams. This year, Stafford, before this game's even factored, it probably worth 3.5 wins. Right. So it's right now, because the postseason's factored into this, right now we're looking at maybe a two win difference between last year Goff and this year Stafford. Now, 2018 Goff was probably in this Stafford range, I would say, as far as wins. Yeah, Goff was similar, 3.61. So Stafford's probably going to even upgrade the wins added here. Stafford, with a decent game next week, probably ends up closer to 4 total wins that they've added. So even if you're looking at, let's say he adds half a win over 2018 Jared Goff, is a half win, I'm doing quick math here, half win, right, which sounds vague, a half win is pretty big over the course of a season for just one player to add. A half win, is that worth 2 first-round picks? Well, a first-round tackle or a first-round edge defender, they're probably worth a quarter of it. They probably do add up to a half win per season. So, they're, you know, just, again, quick math, this is the type of stuff that the Rams we're contemplating here.
And,
giving the benefit of the doubt. I'm giving the best version of Jared Goff. The current version of Jared Goff, the more consistent version of Jared Goff, Stafford has been worth the upgrade at a glance so far this season.
Yeah, and if that half win is the difference between a Super Bowl and not, like, that's what they're chasing here. So, again, like, a lot of people were ridiculously critical about almost everything the Rams have done from a strategy standpoint right now, and there's still two more games that they need to win for it to pay off. But, like, right now it's working.
I think, I mean, I was, as usual, a fence sitter in a lot of this. I thought the offense would get better. I don't know by how much, but the offense would get better and that Stafford would play at a similar level as the rest of his career. And that's where we're at right now. We'll see if it does pay off. So the end of the game, too, unbelievable. So Brady hits Evans on a 55-yard touchdown. It's like, okay, this could happen. The Rams then, all they need to do is get a first down.
Yeah.
If the Rams get a first down against the Bucs who have no timeouts, this game's over. They run a run play. They run a second run play after the two-minute warning, right? Or just before it. After, I think it was after. And Ndamukong Suh forces the fumble on Cam Akers. Bucs get the ball, 35-yard line, whatever it was. They pick up what looks like a first down to Cameron Brate. He's just short, fourth and inches. So it's fourth and inches, fourth and one, half a yard, whatever it is. Everybody's expecting the Brady sneak, so you're going to sneak it, get up to the line, run a couple pass plays, and the Bucs have a chance to tie it up. Instead, they run Leonard Fournette. And I always say, I think this is part of the Brady opening things up. He opens up the outside run in short yardage when you take away the sneak, when everybody's playing it. Fournette bounces out for the touchdown. It's 27-27. And that's when the Rams got the ball back. That drive started with a Stafford sack, that near fumble. But the next two plays, Cooper Kupp and Stafford take over.
Another example of a team being in the situation where they had that decision of do you go for two and try and win the game, or do you take the extra point and play for whatever chance?
There was like a minute left, right?
Yeah, but again, like it doesn't change anything. All it changes, if they score the field goal or the touchdown, you lose anyway, right? Like, if the Rams do what the Rams did and score, it doesn't matter. You lose, right? The only difference is if they don't, you win the game instead of going overtime. That's the only thing that changes. And I just, in the playoffs, I think that that's happened. That's come up three times now, and nobody's gone for it. In the regular season, teams were going for it.
I think the Bucs feel good at that point in the game, and maybe the feelings are the things that you're trying to avoid here. The Bucs are probably feeling good that if they go to overtime, they've got a chance to win it. Now, that could be
right,
false.
But is it a better chance than one play from the two-yard line?
Against the Rams defense, maybe.
The Rams defense that you've just started scoring against. I'm just saying, like, this has now come up three times in the postseason, and teams are 0-3 taking that more aggressive stance. Now, I don't think it's the same teams that were doing it during the regular season, so it's not like an aggressive team has suddenly turtled up and gone conservative, but I just think it's interesting now that this has come up multiple times in the postseason, and not only have none of them gone for it, but I don't think any of them really seriously considered it at any point. So they ended up, they tie it, and then the Rams march down the field and score.
Bruce Arians also had, he also kicked a field goal. Was it 4th and 11?
Yeah.
Kicked a field goal down 27-3. They made it 27-6. That has come up a few times, too, where teams are down two scores plus multiple two-point conversions. This has come up, I think it was the Cowboys against the Niners last week, maybe. It's two scores plus two-point conversions or more. This was, in this case, it was three touchdowns and three two-point conversions. They were down 24. I don't hate the field on a 4th and long call. I don't hate the field goal there. Like, it keeps it as a 3-possession game, but then you don't have to get all of those 2-point conversions, which are all getting 3 of them is already a massive undertaking.
I also wonder. So the interesting thing about that to me is that, like, Brady was fine with it. You know what I mean? Brady. It's not like Brady was sort of going, "Hey, come on, we got to go for it." Like, we
yeah. Because it's 4th and 11. He knows, I mean, that's also part of, like, the game flow thing. This Rams pass rush is getting to you. Converting a 3rd or 4th and long is,
but I think
low,
I think it's a more all encompassing attitude that these guys have. So, like, Peyton Manning is one of those guys, and Troy Aikman, where they're all like, I don't want to go for two until we have to. You know what I mean? I don't want to know
that idea of the analytics says go for two. I know it's a different, slightly different conversation, but the analytics is like go for two early because then you know if you don't get it, you have an extra drive you need to get. You know what I mean? The earlier you have that information, the more you can do something about it and potentially change the outcome. The football guys are like, I don't want to have to go for that play until I need to, because, and I think it's this attitude of like, the thing I've said before where the guys like Montana and Brady and Peyton Manning, when they get that 2-minute drive to win the game, the first play is very often something very inconsequential, but it picks up 5 yards. You know what I mean? Just to start moving, just to get something going. I wonder if there's this sort of collective attitude amongst these guys or this understanding that you just need to take this one play at a time. Like there's a lot, like the next game as well, the Bills, Kansas City, like you can score, you can put up a lot of points in a short period of time if things happen, you know what I mean? But you can't do that if you don't score, if you don't just keep chipping away at it and take it one play at a time. So I wonder if this attitude amongst those quarterbacks in particular, that they're not going to be hyper-aggressive because they understand that you just keep picking up one play, one play, one play, one play, and eventually they're all going to add up and put you back in the game.
Yeah. Yeah, there's something to it. Bucks did get into it. It was 27-27, and then Stafford and Kupp make the plays to take over. Chris read he thought it was a cryptic answer from Tom Brady about potentially retiring and all that. I don't know if that was – I don't know how cryptic it was or not, but –
he said, like, I'm bummed right now. I'm not thinking about the future.
That was post-game.
We'll see.
But during the game, Chris was bringing up a pregame quote from Brady, which I think is more – it was more of like a Brady process answer because he's so – you know, into this whole process-oriented thing. You know, we're going to take time and talk about it. And, you know, I don't like to, you know, I want to live in the moment. And I think that was his answer.
I love the way now as well, like everybody, it's a we thing. You know what I mean? It's like the team's going to get together. And not like, not the football team, like my team.
No, Brady's
collective team.
Him. Yeah. It's him and Giselle.
Him and the missus.
The team.
No, there'll be other people. Like Alex is going to weigh in. You know?
That's true.
I think we got, like, with this avocado oil, I think we got another 5 years here, boss.
You think?
That's the guy.
You think Guerrero is, I don't know, man, I'm ready for retirement.
No, I think he's like, no, look, we've got some new techniques on the horizon. We got, like, water mixed with something else. Like, we're going to get, there's another 6 years in this. I'm telling you.
I mean, the Bucks have some interesting team building decisions because, Gronk, he could retire at any time. Once again, does he actually want to come back one more time? He looked good this year. You've got Chris Godwin as a free agent. Obviously, Antonio Brown is already not coming back. So they've got a group of pass catchers to bring back. And Carlton Davis on the defensive side. So it's not – this year they went all in to bring the band back together. It didn't work out. The Rams went all in to bring new stars to town, and they're off.
Has worked out.
To the NFC Championship. By the way, all of our grades and stats, NFL Pod is your promo code. You get 25% off over at pff.com. Any PFF subscription, 25% off using the promo code NFL Pod. I see the YouTube chat bumping. Type it in there, NFL Pod. Tell your friends. You get 25% off. Don't use the other podcast subscription codes. Can we sneak 30% off just for ours? We can't do that.
Not.
I don't think we're allowed to, especially because, you know, the tailgate dude is in charge of it, Austin. Of this promo. But it's 25% off using the promo code NFL Pod. All these grades and stats are showing up right now, a part of your PFF Edge or Elite package over at pff.com. So you can follow along. So use NFL Pod for 25% off. Anything else here? Brady and...
let's get to the last game.
Brady and Rodgers retirement discussion.
Yeah.
Already started. Do you want to circle back to Bucky's take on the Packers?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Next.
We're going to do the Wednesday Bucky show. Bucky and Dan O takes.
Bucky and
we'll
Dan
just discuss. I'm trying to be nice. I don't. There's no right or wrong here, but they're good thought exercises.
There's a right or wrong with the Dan O stuff. Like, it's coverage bust.
It's all Stafford.
It just is.
It's all Stafford. Bills Chiefs. This thing was just trudging along as a good, solid football game, and then just madness in the fourth quarter. Josh Allen, Patrick Mahomes, head-to-head. Now, historically, when you get two really good quarterbacks, you don't always get shootouts like this. You don't always get answer and answer. And this was...
I mean, it wasn't even a shootout until, like, the last 2 minutes.
It just all happened. It all happened in the end.
It was like a, you know, each team scores 7 in the first quarter, each team scores 7 in the second quarter, 7-9 in the third quarter, and then, like, the last 2 minutes of the fourth quarter was just a mad explosion.
Mahomes deserves a ton of credit, obviously. He was fantastic. Tyreek Hill and Travis Kelce showed their star power.
Yeah.
I thought it was fascinating on the other side. Stephon Diggs only had 3 catches for 7 yards.
Well, yeah, because who might the name?
Jarvarius Ward?
No. Whose receiver just went ape?
Oh, Gabriel Davis.
Yeah, Davis turns into Jerry Rice.
I'm not lamenting this like the Bills needed, you know, Stephon Diggs to catch more passes. Gabriel Davis looked
200
like,
yards and 4 touchdowns.
He looked like a combination of T.O. and Jerry Rice at 6'3", 215, in, you know, 4'4 type of speed.
And wrecking people with moves.
Like, that's what I mean.
Like just throwing the corner post shuffle and the guy falls over.
It was unbelievable. He had the 75-yarder. So that was when this thing kind of started, right? The Chiefs get up 9, and Josh Allen comes back with his next throw, next drive, 75 yards in stride, just an absolute bomb. And this is my favorite thing. The arm strength matters. People came out. And, hey, for Josh Allen, absolutely. His arm strength matters. 75-yard bomb. This was one of those throws like you're just throwing it behind where the defense is expecting to cover. 75-yard touchdown to Gabriel Davis. Gabriel Davis then later on makes Mike Hughes fall down on a little jab post move. I mean, it was unbelievable what Gabriel Davis did in this game. Also, so much of this game was... As great as the passing stats are for Josh Allen and Patrick Mahomes slithering out of sacks, hit a 35-yard scramble early in the first quarter, and he just continued to avoid those negative plays, pick up some yards on the ground, whereas Josh Allen was like Mark Bavaro in the open field, just trucking people, like legitimate tight end, speedy tight end, hurting people in the open field. Josh Allen on design runs, QB sweeps, on scrambles, whatever it is. It was just an unreal back-and-forth battle between both teams here.
Yeah, it was crazy. The last couple of minutes was absolute madness. Like, these quarterbacks were just both dealing. They were both playing out of their minds. Patrick Mahomes, it's funny. So we've been making this point, right, that this was the team that the Bills were designed to beat, right? They went out and they lost to the Chiefs last year in the AFC Championship game, and they've assembled this roster to try and take down this Kansas City team. And one of the ways they did that, the broadcast was making this point, they go and draft 2 pass rushers because they didn't get enough pressure on Patrick Mahomes. They know they can't blitz him, so they've got to try and win more up front with just 4 guys and get him that way. And so they actually get a reasonable amount of pressure on him in this game, but they just can't get hold of the damn guy. There's so many plays where they're collapsing the pocket. There's multiple players getting pressure on him. They're chasing him down, and they just cannot get him to the ground. That guy is like an eel in the pocket, just slithers like left and right, somehow gets out of it, and keeps and then goes. And as soon as he takes off, like I've said before, his 40 time is half a tenth of a second faster than the guy chasing him, regardless of how fast that guy is, right? Somehow you just cannot chase him down from behind. Once he's out there running, he's gonna get away. And they just could not track him down. And then Kansas City, those freak athletes that they've had, Tyreek Hill, you know, Mecole Hardman with his speed, Travis Kelce, those guys kept winning. Like they found all of them with the ball. All of those guys found ways to make some plays and show that, like, you know, Tyreek Hill's still the fastest dude in the NFL. Mecole Hardman has those plays where, okay, he might not be able to step up and be a number one or a number two, but if you can get him the ball with a bit of space and wiggle room, boom, that can be a big play and a touchdown. And Travis Kelce remains unstoppable. Like, those guys were just racking up points for them.
Yeah, I mean, Hardman's first touchdown run, a 26-yarder where he did not have room and he just... squirted right through there. Not 26. That was a 25-yarder. Sorry. He had a 26-yard reception as well. There's just so much space in this Kansas City offense. Mahomes, ridiculous stat, 177 yards after the 2-minute warning. That included the 64-yarder to Tyreek Hill. As I said, just throw the 70-yarder to Tyreek Hill. I tweeted that about 20 seconds before it actually happened. Nailed it, Steve. But, man, Tyreek Hill is just ridiculous with the ball in his hands. He actually lost some yards because I thought, you know, he's like the one guy where you can kind of go backwards, yeah. And I still can't believe how fast he is. I still can't believe he's that much faster than everybody else on the football field.
It's crazy.
Supposedly there was a check at the line on the game win, so a game winning walk off touchdown, Mahomes to Kelce, that they had some sort of like backyard adjustment to that play. Back shoulder to Kelce, and Mahomes confirmed it with his cadence at the line of scrimmage, like do it or something like that, and Kelce did it, and they threw it, and it was the best throw Mahomes made all day. I mean, Mahomes was good, but as far as making throws, I mean, his first touchdown to Pringle was kind of ridiculous too, right? They were doing that.
Yes.
It was a fake rollout. It was like a fake roll to the right, roll out to the left that was covered, and then he rolled back to the right. Is that what they were doing?
I don't know. All I know is when he started rolling right, there were suddenly three guys in his face, and he just had to like loft it over the top.
Yeah, it was insane.
To be able to find a guy with that kind of pressure in your face is pretty nuts.
Yeah, back to that spatial awareness thing. So it still makes you wonder what – I mean, look, not every – players aren't perfect. But the midseason slump that the Chiefs had, that was real.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, let's not have – you can have revisionist history if you're like, hey, Mahomes is never going to be good again. The Chiefs are figured out. If people said that, I don't think we got to that point. But we said, look, they have to make an adjustment here. The league has done stuff to change how they stop this team. And again, Mahomes and the Chiefs have done in the second half of the year a much better job of taking the underneath stuff over and over again.
They were patient in this game without making the mistakes. I mean, earlier in the game, I think they had like a 15-play drive that chewed up a giant amount of clock and scored a touchdown. Like that was – they weren't doing that earlier in the season when teams like Buffalo were forcing them into these situations. They were panicking. They were making mistakes, and they were turning the ball over instead of scoring touchdowns. So Kansas City has figured out how to do that and how to be more patient and succeed. So Josh Allen was incredible in this game. And God, like I'm getting more and more impressed by him every week. Like, can you imagine if you're a team with a quarterback that's just like good or has okay tools and is just a normal, like just a regular human NFL quarterback, and you're watching this game and you're like, what the hell is this? Look at these two guys that are just super freaks. Like, you've got Josh Allen, who's this unstoppable force on the ground, who's got a cannon for an arm, who can make all these throws, and every time they need a big play, he comes up big. And then you got Mahomes doing like almost completely impossible to stop in the pocket. You just can't get to him. And then as soon as he breaks contain, there's a big play waiting to happen. Like, it's unbelievable the plays that these two guys were trading in this game. Like, late in the game, there was a play where Josh Allen, he basically had to beat three different guys to get to like start scrambling and get to the first down. Like, and he doesn't make that, the game might be over. Three different people had a shot at him, and he makes them all miss and just rolls over it. One thing I do think that's interesting in this game, the Bills kind of made a mess of it from a play-calling standpoint a few different times. Early in the game, it was like 4th and 2, and you run Josh Allen like a QB sweep, like QB power or whatever it was. You have to do that. Every 4th and short with Josh Allen, it should be – that's what they've been doing recently, right? We dial up a play for Josh Allen because you can't stop that, right? He breaks defensive schemes. Being able to have a guy like that who, like Mark Bavaro, just runs over people, can beat them with speed, can beat them with moves – you don't have a fix to that on the defense, right? There's nothing you can do that takes away all of those options. So early in the game, they did it. I do not understand. It was, what, 3rd quarter, 5 minutes left. The Bills, they're down 17-14, 4th and 1 from, okay, their own 34. But still, do you really want to punt that ball away to Patrick Mahomes when you have Josh Allen, 4th and 1 with Josh Allen? Like, there are plays.
What was the time left here?
There are 5 minutes left in the third quarter.
Third quarter, yeah.
Like, they
went for the 4th and 2 early in the game.
Yes, the first drive, I think.
First drive.
So the Chiefs have just scored a field goal. Buffalo is now down 17-14.
Yep.
And they essentially go 3 and out. They get 7 yards on first down. They don't get anywhere on second down. Third down was the kind of handoff to McKenzie?
Yes.
And everyone's like, oh, what a terrible play call that is. You're like, oh, okay, it's not a great play call. But on the other hand, it's now fourth and one.
Fourth and one.
Why are you punting?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, your own 34. So that's definitely not ideal field position. But you surely you have to back your idea of I can pick up a yard with Josh Allen at quarterback, right? We've seen over the last few weeks there are so many things you can do to effectively guarantee that yard. Like, he's one of the best sneak quarterbacks in the NFL. There are plays where you can go empty and run him right up the middle that are literally unstoppable. And by the way, Patrick Mahomes is on the opposition, right? Like, what? You have to treat this game as you can't give him the ball back.
There are two schools of thought on this, right? The risk of going for it in your own territory. If you're playing a great offense, the great offense is literally two plays away from being in the same exact spot that you would have left them anyway.
Right. And right? the idea that you need to – the extra 45 yards from the punt – is the difference between them scoring and not? It's not. Like, the whole point is, that's Patrick Mahomes over there. He's probably scoring whatever you do.
Yes. And so the one school of thought is, if you're playing a great offense, just if you give them a short field, are you doing them a favor? Sure. But they're probably going to get back to the short field anyway. But if you're playing a bad offense, are you doing them a favor by putting them into field goal range, essentially, when they're not moving the ball? In this particular instance, you know, it's even with the Chiefs taking a slight step back this season offensively, it's still the Chiefs. They're still capable, so remaining aggressive.
And they still have, like,
all that stuff didn't necessarily matter, because Hardman comes back with the 25-yard run that we talked about, missed the extra point. It's 23-14. Next play, Josh Allen to Gabriel Davis, 75-yard touchdown.
Right, but on the other hand, like, instead of Mecole Hardman scoring a touchdown, you had a chance to keep the ball.
Sure.
Potentially take the lead yourself. And it's a different ball game, right?
Right.
You now have the momentum.
Possession.
And the onus is on Kansas City.
In a game like this, possession's the most important thing.
Right.
Is the bottom
line. And again, you have a cheat code at quarterback. And you've already deployed that cheat code. Like, the first drive of the game, you went for it on fourth and two. Why all of a sudden have you gone conservative and don't want to break it out just because it's on your own 34? I was blown away that they punted that ball.
How about punting the ball to Tyreek Hill? Multiple times.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't do that either.
That's the other. So we get into the fourth quarter. It's still a 2-point game, I believe, right? The Bills punt, 54 yards. Tyreek Hill runs out of bounds for 13 yards. But there are offsetting penalties on the play. So now Buffalo has to punt from their 15. And when you punt from your 15, you're in this difficult spot where you certainly don't want to get the punt blocked, because if it's blocked, it's like a touchdown or a safety, right? So you have to protect a little bit. And if you punt it, you're punting, and you know that you know the punt returner is going to be in the open field. It's not like a coffin corner situation. And they punt it back to Tyreek Hill, who is just, again, at a different level from everybody else on the field. 45-yard return there. And this is what made this game insane, because every time, I mean, that just felt like, well, now this is Kansas City's game, right? They're already winning. Tyreek Hill's taken over, 45-yard touchdown, punt return. Now, as unstoppable as we're talking about these offenses being, the Chiefs started this drive from the 16-yard line. They started a drive early in the fourth quarter from the 16-yard line and only got a field goal out of it. Because
three runs,
they got too cute, right? McKinnon for three, McKinnon for five, including a fumble that gets recovered by Andrew Wiley. And then they go the direct snap to Blake Bell. The Belldozer runs the speed option. He was the Belldozer in college.
Belldozer.
He was, Oklahoma thought he was their Josh Allen. He was Josh Allen as a runner in college, just without the cannon and now the accuracy that Allen has. That goes for negative 3 yards. Nice play to stop it by the Bills. So the Chiefs only get a field goal, 28-yarder. Now it's 26-21. And then the crazy stuff started.
Yeah.
After all of that.
Not even then. I mean, like, really, we get the Chiefs or the Bills spend, like, basically the next 6 minutes, 7 minutes driving for a touchdown. They get that Gabriel Davis one. They get the 2-point conversion. And now we're off to the races. Because, like, great, you scored. 2 minutes left. Patrick Mahomes with the ball. Game over. Like, the Chiefs are going to score. Forget it. Like, of course. That's too much time. Too much time on the clock for a quarterback like Mahomes. And it was. Turns out it was way too much time because the Chiefs score almost immediately. Buffalo now has
rush.
The ball.
Don't rush. Don't rush. I want to go through this drive. The Bills get the ball at 8:55.
Yes.
Okay. They score with right at the 2-minute warning. But along the way, like the roller coaster of emotions that occurred for both fan bases along, because this was like methodical, right? And the Bills are like, all right, we're just going to put the ball in Josh Allen's hands. And on this play, they ran him for -1 on a second down, but he also picks up a third down. He gets stopped on 3rd and 6. And like Romo was saying, he's like, oh, you know, they're just, you know, picking up a few yards. They're going to go for it on 4th. On 4th and 4, Josh Allen scrambles and hurts. And this is when he, was it Tre'Davious Ward? Who did he hit?
And that was the play where he evaded 3 different people to get out of that.
On 4th and 4 to pick it up. So then, you know what,
like
I
Melvin
felt?
Melvin Ingram was in his face immediately. Ingram and then he has to beat Ingram. Then he has to beat some other guy who's chased into the flat because Ingram's forced him out of the pocket. And then barrel over one more guy to get the first down.
So I thought at that point, he comes back with an incompletion and then another run. I thought at that point, Allen was getting a little bit too run heavy, right? Because they go incompletion, they run again on 2nd and 10, then it's 3rd and 6. And this was where it was like, okay, now the Bills definitely lost the game. Here's what happens. Allen's a little bit under pressure. I thought he started to drop his eyes. I thought he was trying to do too much outside the pocket instead of winning from the pocket. And he dumps it off to Devin Singletary. This wasn't a screen or anything. This was kind of like a panic throw to Singletary, who catches it for a 7-yard loss.
Yeah.
Which then puts the Bills at 4th and 13. So now it's like, okay, this game's over, right? It's 4th and 13. Until Gabriel Davis runs the best route in NFL history. Puts Mike Hughes on his buttocks. 27 yard touchdown.
Yeah.
As ridiculous as that play was, Josh Allen's 2-point conversion was even better. Because you can't just have a 1-point lead with Patrick Mahomes on the other side with 2 minutes. You're going to lose. You have to get the 2-point conversion to make the Chiefs tie it at least. And Allen scrambles out and somehow finds Stephon Diggs. This didn't count as one of his 3 catches, but it still matters. That play was as ridiculous as anything else Josh Allen pulled out in this game.
Yeah.
Your thoughts?
It was.
Okay.
Those 2 plays back-to-back were...
This is John Elway type stuff.
Yeah, those 2 plays back-to-back were special. And at that point, you're like, okay, that's great, but there's too much time left on the clock for Patrick Mahomes to answer. This is going to be a problem. And then the Chiefs score really quickly. Like they take less than a minute to answer. And honestly, at that point, I was like, you know what? That's not the worst thing that's happened for the Bills.
You did say that, yeah. You did say that to me.
So I tried to tweet it. And I was like, this is the best thing that could happen for the Bills. And I was like, no, that's stupid.
There is a better thing.
The best thing that could happen is they force an immediate turnover and they have the ball without, you know, conceding a touchdown and everything's great. If you're going to give up the score, this is the best way of doing it, right? Give up a touchdown very quickly and give yourself a minute to answer. And that's exactly what happened. So you get the ball with a minute. Allen does it again. Allen marches down the field again. They score another touchdown to Gabriel Davis. And now you're like, perfect. Game winner. You just won. 13 seconds left on the clock. That's it. The game's done. And then, like, even at the time, I was like, 13 seconds, Mahomes? Even.
You're going too fast again.
Even Mahomes.
You're going too fast again. Because the Tyreek Hill 64-yarder.
Yeah.
How does he run through the defense like that?
He's Tyreek Hill. That's what happens. But on reflection, like, that's probably, you know, the defense is beginning to get pretty knackered at that point. And that's probably one of the plays that helped them get very knackered. Like, that defense is all of a sudden sprinting a long way a lot of the time.
And this is the thought exercise I want to go through here. What's the best way to have the defense completely worn out in the fourth quarter? Because, I don't want to take anything away from Allen or Mahomes. You know, obviously, it's not just a two-man game. There's more than just the quarterback. But those guys were special and incredible. The playmakers were special and incredible. But how much of this end of the game is just the defense has no answers? Or my baseball analogy, right, that I gave you. In baseball, they found out, the more hitters get to see pitchers, the more it's to the hitter's advantage. Is there a football equivalent? Is there value in just running a whole bunch of passing plays, right? If you can, just because you could see what the defense is giving you? Is it to the offense's advantage over time in today's NFL that the more plays that they run, not just for, you know, fatigue factor, but as far as figuring out defenses, is it to the offense's advantage? Or am I extrapolating this too far? It's just a whole bunch of special playmakers, including Gabriel Davis in this one, just took over and they were unstoppable. But at the end of the game, the defenses didn't have a shot.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some ugly defense in here.
When you're getting late in the game and the tempo starts to go as crazy as it was, the offense can substitute out receivers, right? Like Tyreek Hill can sprint for 60 yards and Tyreek Hill doesn't have to come back into the game, right? When the 45-yard punt return, Tyreek Hill didn't play the next snap, right? Because the dude's just run 45 yards, he's wrecked. So he didn't play the next snap on offense. The guys on defense, like you sprint as a safety 50 yards for a play, even if it's not complete or not, you got to line back up 35 seconds later and do it again. So those guys are playing every single snap. They're playing that sequence. That end of game madness, I think, just absolutely destroys those defenses because they don't come off the field. They don't have a break. Their break is the 35 seconds between sprints. Like it's, you know, like remember when if you did track and field or whatever in school, like that's the most tiring thing you can do, right? Those like interval sprint things, that's what they're doing at the end of the game. Like that's their rest, is the interval between sprints. There's only so much of that you can do before you're just done. Your gas tank is empty.
I mean, it's bad on the receivers too, right?
But that's what I'm saying. At least those guys can get off the field. Like you do that, you can rotate out.
Yeah.
Somebody else comes in for a snap. You get another 30 seconds of rest. You get to double the amount of rest you have. Like the DBs don't have that. They got to go, and they got to go again, and they got to go again, and you got to go again until the drive ends, and you can get the hell off the field for a while. So I think just the way that end-of-game sequence was going, the craziness, just torches those guys that are playing every snap.
I wonder if that's even a reason to have an extra receiver on your roster and to get those speed guys that are just there to wear down the defense, like just cover me deep over and over and over again. You got to investigate this further, but there's a minute two left. The Bills they're down four. So this is a must. This is a touchdown needing drive.
Yeah.
You need a touchdown here. And Josh Allen gets the 28-yarder to Gabriel Davis, a 12-yarder to Gabriel Davis, eventually gets a 16-yarder to Emmanuel Sanders, and then Gabriel Davis up the seam for the 19-yarder.
Huge couple of plays because he took the shot to Stephon Diggs. And
miscommunication
Diggs,
one, right?
Diggs was literally not even trying to catch it. He was trying to break it up. Like,
oh, that way, yeah, yeah.
He goes up with it, goes up one-handed with this hand and is literally just trying to bat it out of bounds because it's closer to the corner than it is to Diggs. So, and Diggs, by the way, throughout his career has always been really good at that.
Like,
saving.
A sense for saving.
Saving bad plays. Yeah. Understanding when I'm not even going to attempt to make a play on this ball. The only play I'm trying to make is a pass breakup at this point. And then the shot to Emmanuel Sanders was contested as well. Like that was into some pretty tight coverage and Sanders comes up with it big. Then you get the touchdown to Davis. They answer and you're like 13 seconds. And at the time you're like 13 seconds, Mahomes, maybe. No.
I thought it was that silly. I was like, okay, we've just seen. If the game ended there, it was one of the best games of
all
time.
Right, and you're like, it is exactly what you thought would happen. Too much time for Mahomes, he answered, but it was too much time as well for Josh Allen. That's like Allen gets it done. Incredible game by him. One, you know, game-winning drive and all those kinds of things. And you're like, 13 seconds shouldn't be enough time to get this done. Now, mistake number one, they kick the ball out of the back of the end zone for a touchback. And at the time, you know, Romo and Nance are saying, you got to make them return this, right? It's a squib or just something that makes them feel the ball and burn a few seconds of clock. Like, they should have kicked that off. And, this is off the back of saying, what are they doing punting to Tyreek Hill? You know what I mean? But, you have to make them feel this play because 13 seconds should not be enough time to drive for a field goal. 8 seconds is certainly not enough time for it, right? So make them chew up a few seconds. Like, kick it. Do one of those kicks where you know, high hang time, drop it at the 1 yard line, force the guy to come out. You're probably going to end up with a shorter, they're probably not even going to make it to the 25. But even if they do,
it cost them 5 seconds, and that is the most important thing right now, is simply the amount of time on the clock.
So this
they kick it out of the end zone, and the Chiefs get to start this drive with all 13 seconds.
This is where I think the Chiefs trio, Mahomes, Hill, Kelsey, changes all the arithmetic.
Well, also timeouts. The timeouts is
Chiefs had
massive.
Three timeouts. Andy Reid had all of his timeouts at the end of the half.
Which has happened like in the first half as well. You're like, why are you stockpiling these? This is why, apparently, for the last 13 seconds.
He's making up for the last decade.
Yeah. Well, it turns out, no, this is like his one time. You know, it's like, you idiots. You always mock me for trying to keep them with me. This is why. It's for this last 13 seconds of this one game. That's why I wanted all the timeouts.
My feeling, because I'm watching with my wife, and I'm talking through this, right? They kick it deep. And I'm like, don't kick it deep. Make him return it. Make him return it. And I'm like, there's 13 seconds, right? Because the alternative there is if they do get a big return, in normal NFL circumstances, what are the ways the Bills can lose that game with 13 seconds left? One of the disastrous ways is just a big return, right? You make them return it. All of a sudden, they bring it back to the 50, and it's like, oh, no, there's a Hail Mary situation. Or not even Hail Mary. It's just like they just need 15 yards, and they call timeout, right? That is a disastrous potential situation for the Bills. And when you're facing Mahomes, Hill, even against those guys, like 13 seconds left, you're still probably going to take your chances with 13 seconds.
Of course you're going to take your chances.
Versus 30. If it was 30 seconds, then you're like, okay, maybe we make him return it, steal some seconds here and there.
But the timeouts change everything. Because when you don't have timeouts, that's when teams play that, what is it, like the picket fence defense, where you stack everybody on the sidelines. And you're like, you're not getting a quick 15 yards to the sideline when stop the clock. You have to play the middle of the field, and you don't have the time to get that done, right? That's the defense that the 49ers finally showed up with against the Cowboys, daring them essentially to do what they did, which is run a QB draw or something over the middle that burns all your time and you've got nothing left. You can't do that with all of your timeouts because they can target the middle of the field and then immediately call a timeout and keep the clock alive. So the fact that Kansas City had those timeouts meant that you actually had to play this honestly and show up with a normal defense and just stop them. So they were in an unusually difficult defensive situation relative to just like there's 13 seconds and no time. So the single most the most important thing for you as a defense, as the defending team, is force them to start that drive with 8 seconds left, not with 13. Which you can do by kicking. And okay, there is a small risk that they can return that kick for something huge and put you in a bind. But it almost never happens. Particularly those ones where you're like lofting it to make them field it at the one. Like the average start position for those is terrible. It's way short of the 25. So they're probably going to have a longer field to go anyway. And you burned like a third of the time. They didn't.
They let them have it.
All 13 seconds.
How do you play defense then?
You actually have to play a normal defense. Like you can't. They ran like the softest prevent in the world and went, we're just going to make sure essentially you don't pick up a 50 yard play.
I think the Bills were thinking, Tyreek Hill changes this entire equation, right? As does Mahomes, right? Because they're at the 25, and then they get to the 40, almost to midfield. And by then, it's like, well, Mahomes can certainly throw it to the end zone. I think the Bills are picturing this worst-case scenario where Tyreek is behind the defense.
But that first play, like, look at the way they lined up. Look how soft that defense was. You have to play something normal on that first down.
And they throw it to Tyreek. He goes out of bounds for 19 yards, and he's going to do that faster than anybody in the NFL.
Yeah.
And so you still have enough time there. Then I think that's where the next mistake was. But again, I'm sitting there thinking, like, I could still picture Tyreek getting behind this defense for like a 60-yarder or whatever it was at
the
time.
I mean, I understand it's not like it's a difficult situation, but like you have to you can't make it that easy. And I think this is teams get into this situation, like the prevent defense generally. They get into this thing where they're like, we just can't give up the huge play. Like, yeah, but like how often do you give up the huge play? Like you actually have to start factoring in What is our usual baseline playing normal defense of giving up this catastrophic play?
I want to reiterate. Let me take you back to 2017 really quickly. In 2017, Tyreek Hill made a play that I don't think has ever occurred in the NFL. Remember the end of the half against Dallas, right? They dumped it off to Tyreek Hill. We see this hundreds of thousands of times in NFL history. You dump it off, everybody's playing prevent, they come up, they tackle him, and he ran through the defense for a touchdown before the half.
Yeah.
That play like won the passer rating title for Alex Smith that year because of Tyreek Hill. All I'm saying is you have two players on the field in this end of the game situation, Mahomes and Tyreek Hill, that can do stuff that you've never seen before.
And
that put Buffalo in enough of a bind that it let them get into field goal range.
Let me just
easily
articulate for you where this defense lined up, right? We're playing with two high safeties, one of whom is 32 yards off the line of scrimmage, the other of whom is 26, right? So your safeties are literally not in the play. They are lining up on Mars somewhere, and their job is literally just don't get, like, if there's a touchdown here, stop it. They then have a line of three guys, linebackers and a DB, lining up, 10, 15 yards off the line of scrimmage, right? So you're immediately giving them 15. They've got two corners that are essentially just parked nowhere on an island in the flat, but they're literally not covering the receivers. Like, the Chiefs have a bunch formation on the left side of the field. Levi Wallace is the corner to that side. He's playing 10 yards off and 5 yards outside leverage. Like, he's not covering that. So he's sort of doing that take away the sideline thing, but that's all he's doing. And then they rush four, sort of. They rush three guys, and they had one guy kind of dithering at the line as like a QB spy. But they literally gave up exactly what the Chiefs took, which is dump it off to Tyreek, and then you have a lot of room in front of you to get some yardage.
They should have zero blitzed.
And as soon as you do that, we can call a timeout. But what I'm saying is you've got seven guys there who are essentially not playing defense, but are playing just to not give up a 50-yard play, right?
I would have put four guys to not give up the 50-yard play.
Yeah. I'm just saying, why not run cover two, quarters, anything normal from the playbook? Like, anything that's generally designed not to give up a 50-yard touchdown, but can also stop, like, routine 20-yard plays.
Your friend Mike Lombardi said something like, we've got to press the receivers and knock them off their route. I could just picture this. So if you press the receivers, you got four men rushing. You need four guys pressing, right? And then you've got your three safeties. Tyreek Hill destroys that press. He's already into the secondary.
Yeah.
You throw a seam route to him, and you're in field goal range. Or he just decides, okay, I'm past the first guy. I'm going full Randy Moss. I'm getting by this one safety I need to beat, right? Because there's three across. I'm going to go by this, and Mahomes just throws it over the top. I mean, it is the weirdest thing to say. With 13 seconds, I'm watching the Bills defense saying, I don't know exactly what they should do. I think you articulated it fine. Like, there is a middle ground.
What they ran?
You have to stop the field. You have to make an attempt at stopping the field goal, too. And say, like, look, if Patrick hits a 65-yarder, like, you know, good on you.
What they ran was essentially cover two, right? But a cover two where, like, the softness slider was ramped up to like 185%, where everyone was playing 15 yards deeper than they're supposed to be.
Yeah.
Like, literally just run cover two. Anything. Like, any base coverage shell. Run that. Just don't run what you ran, which is like we're playing so soft to not give up the one catastrophic play that we're going to give you anything else you want from the playbook.
So they get into field goal range. Harrison Butker. The next Justin Tucker. Hits the field goal, 49-yarder, whatever it was. And we're going to overtime.
Was he the guy that missed the 47-yarder from short earlier? Was that this game?
No, that was Matt Gay.
Oh, Matt Gay.
With the Rams. That's the other part of the Todd Bowles decision.
That was weird, by the way.
Well, he got hurt. He had something tweaked or something in pregame, Matt Gay, the Rams kicker. He had something tweaked in pregame. It looked fine for most of the game, and then all of a sudden, the 47-yarder, which also like would have sealed the game for the Rams, just showed up, just ended short. It looked like it was through, right, on TV.
That's what I thought, yeah.
And then they go, no good, it's short.
What?
So that was the other part of like the Todd Bowles decision. When you zero blitz, they have a field goal kicker who just couldn't reach a 47-yarder. You can't, you know. So Todd Bowles goes zero blitz. Bills go softest cover two in history. They both led to field goals to the opposing team. Chiefs get the ball in overtime. Felt like such a downer when they handed it off the first time. It's like after all that craziness, they go handoff for four. Anyway, it still worked out. They They drive down the field. You've got Jerick McKinnon for 16, and then Mecole Hardman takes it. That was his 26-yarder, open, just wide open, and on a crossing route, busted coverage by the Bills. And they just, as you texted me, looked gassed. It was over. Back shoulder from Mahomes to Kelsey.
As soon as this hit overtime, you were just like, the Bills' defense has just got nothing left. Like, they looked like a UFC fighter that's emptied the tank in the first couple of rounds. And, like, the third round, that guy's just staggering around. Like, you know, just has nothing left. Like, literally just waiting for somebody else to end the fight. The Bills' defense had nothing left. And this is why, if you're going to hate on the overtime rules, like, this is why. Because all of a sudden, defense in this game is no longer a fair fight. Like, defense is just there because they can't get off the field anymore. So it's no longer like a fair competition. Like, the team that has the ball is going to score and going to score a touchdown, and that's your game. Like, that, I think, does change the dynamic of, well, I'll just play defense. Yeah, but, like, your defense is shot now. It's done. And that shouldn't be a way the game ends, but it is.
The Chiefs end up with over 200 yards after the catch. Once again, Mahomes only threw a third of his passes beyond the line of scrimmage. Again, I'm not trying to take anything away.
Sounds like you are.
From Mahomes here, who was outstanding. But this entire Chiefs offense is back to just being crazy difficult to defend. But I think that point of how do you make the defense back, that's what they do in college. That's why teams like to run tempo. It's in part to run more plays. Even if you have a few less effective plays in there, at some point you'll get to the good ones. You run more plays and you tire out the defense. I wonder if there's, in the pass-happy NFL, if that's just another part of this. Like, drop back 50 times. It's going to be ugly and uncomfortable every now and again. But if you really want to wear down the defense, passing is the one thing that does it. Or having Derrick Henry. But most people don't have Derrick Henry.
True.
Right? So most teams do have a quarterback and receivers that you can wear down the defense. I wonder if that's a part of it. I'm not here for overtime discourse. I will say college rules, stupid, right? In part because I'm a big, you know, don't want to ruin the stats. Imagine like a 7 overtime game where it's like Patrick Mahomes ends the game with 11
yards.
Touchdowns. Because what happens is you start at the 25 and the quarterback throws for like 9 scores. He had 9 and Allen had 8 passing touchdowns because all the stats count. The other part is you cannot, if you're the NFL, you cannot preach player safety and then put rules in place that are going to make you play more plays. You just can't do that. Now, has the NFL ever contradicted themselves before? Sure. They want to take away helmet-to-helmet hits, and they're inciting more passing, and that's where you get more helmet-to-helmet hits, all that stuff. But it's really tough for the NFL to be like, let's play a full quarter, when you see the exhaustion level that players get to at the end of the fourth quarter.
I mean, this is just an example of why you can't have it be determined on like the flip of a coin and which team gets the ball, because it's only going to end in one direction. Like, both defenses, I suspect both defenses, though we never quite got to see if the Chiefs would have been reacted the same, but I suspect both defenses at this point are absolutely shot, and whichever offense had the ball was going to march down and score a touchdown and end the game. Like, that's just dumb. Like, in a game that has become offense and nothing else, you can't then go, well, if one offense scores a touchdown, done. That's just silly. But then so is every other overtime option out there. So
long show, but it was all worth it.
Hell of a weekend.
It was really impressive. Good job, NFL. Only 2 out of 6 wild card games were all that good. And
that's the thing. Like, wild card weekend kind of sucked as a spectacle. A lot of blowouts, a lot of just bad games. And then this weekend made up for it, and then some. And the championship games look fun.
So you got Niners and Rams, part 3.
Yep.
And Chiefs-Bengals.
Part 2.
And the two favorites are the teams that are 0-3. The favorites are 0-3 against their respective opponents this weekend. Chiefs lost to the Bengals. Niners lost to the Rams twice.
Oh, I was like, how can the Chiefs be 0-3 against the Bengals?
So when you add it up.
Yeah, I get you now.
It's 0-3. So yeah, should be. We'll be here Thursday. We'll preview in all those games. We'll get into some more offseason talk. We'll discuss Bucky Brooks' timeline. Not from a hate standpoint, simply that he brings up a lot of good thoughts
thought. Look, this is it's very useful points. If Bucky is the barometer of the narrative.
Yeah, I just
the
I
narrative,
think,
quote unquote.
I think, you know, any of the scout heavy type of accounts are going to give you insight as to what the NFL's thinking. Right? Or, you know, even I think, you know, the Burt Breers of the world were tweeting, like, if you're in the AFC and you're watching this, you got to rethink your quarterback situation. Because, you know, unless you have Joe Burrow or Justin Herbert, and you think he forgot Lamar, unless you have those three, how are you going to compete with Josh Allen and Patrick Mahomes for the rest of eternity here?
Yeah.
Because they're both locked up for the next X number of years. And I think there's some truth to that. Again, it's not like they both play like this all the time. You know, they don't both play this well all the time, but it just shows what they're capable of. And Allen's two-game stretch is as good as we've seen in the playoffs in a long time. So Mahomes had a great two-game stretch in 2019. You got Foles in 2017. But a two-game stretch that Allen put together, which was – it would have gone down as legendary if he just was able to continue playing. And now they're out. Feel for Bills fans. That is a heartbreaker.
Yeah. Really was.
I mean, for all the fan bases, really.
I mean, lost. Scoring 13 seconds. But, like, the Bills really were – they were big contributors to that. They played a defense that let that happen. They kicked off in a way that didn't take – I mean, take the kickoff just on its own, right? You kick the ball off. You make them field it at the one. They get to the 22-yard line, but it costs them 5 seconds. All of a sudden, you've got 8 seconds to play with, and you still need to go that distance. It's not possible anymore. You just took it away.
You don't have to squib it. Because if you squib it, you'd still put them at the 35. You just kick it to the 1.
Just make them field it.
They're going to go to the 25 because they want to get to, like, a reasonable field position before they probably – and that's the other thing. The kick returner probably gives himself up, right? Does he give himself up and lose the 4 or 5 seconds, or does he try to make a play?
But, I mean, if he does that. Yeah, if you can loft it to the 1 or it's anywhere inside the 5 – if that guy feels it and literally takes a knee immediately, one, it chewed up a second. So, and at this point, a second is actually valuable.
Well, he wouldn't do it at the 1.
But that's the thing, right? So you got to do it. Like, either he's feeling it and taking it as far as he can take it, and it's going to cost 5 seconds, or he literally takes a knee the second the ball hits his hands and gives himself up immediately because the most valuable thing is seconds on the clock, at which point you're literally volunteering to start the drive at, like, the 4-yard line because the seconds are more valuable than the field position. Either way, you win as the kickoff team.
I just want to respond to this really quickly. Mo Egger, local Cincinnati radio host here. He says, the way Zach Taylor handled the final moments of the Kansas City win a few weeks ago makes a little bit more sense now, doesn't it? Remember all of that situation. The Bengals are tied up, and they keep, instead of just kicking the go-ahead, the game-winning field goal to go up by 3 and give Mahomes 50 seconds, 40 seconds, 30 seconds, they kept going for the touchdown and eventually got it and left Mahomes with zero time.
Yeah.
Or they eventually got to the game-winning field goal to leave him with zero time. There's Mo Egger. I mean, that is really interesting, right? Because at the time, people, the Bengals are crazy. What's Zach Taylor doing? And it really is Mahomes and Tyreek and those guys changing the math in end-of-game situations because of what they're capable of. And we'll see if that ends up – see if we get that same situation this weekend.
But it also shows how insanely difficult it is. Like, think of Mike McCarthy, this situation. Like, the absurd, unique situations that you have to, like, game plan for so that you don't screw it up live at the time is insane. Like, okay, Mike McCarthy butchered the draw call, even though he claims, like, yeah, we practice it religiously, it's a 13-second play for us. Well, for everyone else, it's a 17- or 18-second play. That, in and of itself, suggests that you're off on an island and probably shouldn't be calling the play, right? Because something different is going to happen, and when it does, that's the second you need it. Like, and who the hell practices for a 13-second drive?
I know, you can't literally prepare for every situation.
This is a situation different. Where I guarantee nobody has ever practiced this
13
scenario.
Seconds is far different than 20 seconds.
Yes.
Different than 30 seconds.
13, now, not just 13 seconds when they have a bunch of timeouts, right?
Right.
This is the scenario. Like, the last 10 minutes of practice, here's your scenario. 13 seconds on the clock. They've got all their timeouts. You got to stop them scoring. Go. What? Why are we practicing this? This is never going to come up.
But again, this is where I get back to that trio. Who's the trio that made this thing happen? Mahomes, Hill, Kelsey, right? Hill and Kelsey had the two catches that put this into motion. those guys played backyard ball as well as anybody in NFL history, and they just probably did that. They said, look, we know we have 13 seconds. We know we have timeouts. We don't know what the that's the other part. You don't know how the defense is going to play you. We just painted all these different scenarios. The Bills could press a little bit. They could play us not as soft cover two. They could play crazy prevent. They could do all these different things. And you just have to adjust to it on the fly. And the Chiefs clearly were able to do that.
Yeah, but I mean, the other thing that made that happen is the calls from the Bills. Like Leslie Frazier and the head coach they're culpable. I mean, it's an absurd situation to even be practicing ever. But given that they were drawing those up on the fly, they drew it up wrong, start to finish. I'm just saying, keep the energy that everybody had for, like, Mike McCarthy and you're an idiot, right? Fire that man immediately.
Do it for Todd Bowles and for Leslie Frazier / Sean McDermott?
Yeah. I mean, those are – obviously, they've done a better job, I think, than Mike McCarthy overall. But those calls cost the game in addition to, you know, Mahomes and Kelsey and Hill being free.
Yeah, absolutely. It was incredible weekend all the way around.
This is our longest show ever. There's only four games to talk about.
Yeah. But it was the most intense four games. It was the best weekend of football history. I can't believe we got out in 3 hours, to be honest. All right, thanks to everybody for tuning in. We'll be back here on Wednesday. Don't forget to check out the PFF NFL Daily and to get your 25% off over at pff.com. The promo code is NFLPOD, N-F-L-P-O-D. Thank you to everybody for tuning in to the Marathon Divisional Round Review. We'll be back on Wednesday with some more Divisional Round Review, more narrative chatter and some off-season discussion for the other 28 teams that aren't playing anymore.
And the emails.
Thanks, guys. We'll see you Wednesday.